welcome to Sound Sessions here on WGN Radio. My name is Kevin.
And this is Michael Heidemann. Good to see you, Kevin.
You too.
We're back behind the saddle.
I know, and I know you had like another fill-in shift, and I hope that went well, but here we are, reunited again.
I felt so empty without you, Kev.
Hey, I understand.
It's good to be back with the OGs, as they say.
The OG Sound Session crew. So we also have Tom Hush behind the glass here producing.
What's up, Tom?
Howdy, howdy, howdy.
Hey, hey. We got Roger Banish up in the newsroom. Hi, Roger.
Gentlemen, salute.
How is everybody?
Doing great. Yourselves?
Doing real well. I feel a good energy tonight.
You guys always come in here with energy that's off the charts.
That's the pre-workout speaking.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah, Michael's, you know, I like to have a monster sometime because, you know, it's late. Maybe a little coffee or a monster energy drink.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Michael's got the pre-workout going. How's that going for you right now?
Yes. I mean, I feel more alive than ever. I've drank unicorn blood for the last hour and a half, and now I'm ready to go for a show.
Okay, Harry Potter.
Oh, there we go. There we go.
Well, what do we got on the show tonight, Kev? Speaking of positivity and good things.
Well, so for people that don't know, we are typically a music-based show here on the station.
Yeah.
We do a lot of artist interviews, and we do some of the coverage of all the festivals that come through the city. And so we are going to stick to that theme a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So we will be speaking to Tony Mikolaitis. Now, he was kind of your guy. You kind of set this up, and so maybe you can give us a little more insight on him.
Yeah, exactly. So, Kevin, you and I have spoken about doing like a behind-the-business kind of thing, or insider baseball, almost, when it comes to the music industry.
Yeah.
And last week, well, I guess a few weeks ago, we spoke to our good friend who is the accountant for the Beatles and the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
And now we're talking to U2's first concert promoter, and David Bowie's first concert promoter as well. I don't know if he was the first, but he was one of David Bowie's.
I think stateside.
Yes.
He really helped establish them here.
Yeah, stateside. So he did that, and then what we did, we interviewed him, and he told us all these amazing stories, whether it be, you know, getting U2 to start their, get their first album off the ground, seeing what kind of venues they needed to play, to, you know, just some fooling around the studio,
I guess. Pretty cool. And this is, to kind of piggyback on the U2 thought, something I want to do after we take a break at around 2:15 or so, I want to do a segment just to, I'm kind of a contrarian, I think, in life.
You don't say so.
Well,
okay.
I feel like there was a sense of sarcasm there. But speaking of U2, I feel like, you know, they're pretty well universally loved. Not a fan.
Yeah, so you mean by a contrarian, you mean the fact that you love something, but it became, or you don't, you can't like something because it came too big, too famous, too
it's nice. Not. It's not that. Well, I guess what I want to throw out to listeners, and again, you can reach us at 312-981-7200. That's the call line and the text line. Mm-hmm. And you can tweet us. We've got all sorts of social media stuff here. We're at SoundSeshPod on Twitter. But yeah, what is something that is universally loved?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that speaks highly of it. Everybody just loves it, and you can't stand it. You know.
Yeah.
So let's continue to talk about what's coming up on the show. But after the break, I want to do that.
Yeah, we gotta put these things in their place. They've gotten too big.
Listen, Bono.
It's about time to put Bono in his place, is what we're saying.
A little big for his britches.
So,
but anyway.
Be sure to tweet us or call us at 312-981-7200 or in our Twitter, again, at SoundSeshPod. We have our Instagram that is blowing up. It's a fantastic place to go see our photos, all of our artist interviews as well, SoundSessionsWGN. You can check us out on iTunes at iTunes.com/SoundSessions. Be sure to subscribe, tell a friend, leave a review. We'll be sure to get you know, something great, a little goodie or something if we see a review and that we like on that page.
Speaking of goodies, don't we have a giveaway tonight?
Oh, yes, we do. In fact, for the best contrarian story tonight, to all our listeners, call in 312-981-7200 because we have tickets to give away to the Chicago Open Air Festival, which is the premier metal, hard rock, basically pop rock in general.
Who are I think Kiss is one of the headliners
Kiss
this year.
Is one of the headliners. Seether, Slayer, Rob Zombie, Stone and Sour. If you like any of these bands, just they're huge, huge groups, and it's at Toyota Park happening next weekend, 3 days. Give us a call. We'll try to get you some tickets because we've got 6 pairs to give away tonight.
So there you go.
And look at that.
So you just tell us what you hate, and then you get some love for that.
Yeah, I feel like it's very metal, though. It's like there's nothing more metal than telling someone that you hate something and then getting free tickets.
Unintentionally. Brilliant setup there.
Thank you.
But other things we have coming up on the show. Speaking of music, there's this great band that maybe you haven't heard of, maybe you have. You've likely heard their music without realizing it,
mm-hmm.
called Death From Above, and it used to be Death From Above 1979. And we speak to Sebastian Granger. He is both, well, what's neat about this band is they're a two-piece.
Mm-hmm.
And he...
Not a lot of two-piece bands.
No.
That can rock so hard.
Well, what's cool is Sebastian is the drummer, the keyboardist, and the singer.
Jeez.
All at once. That's pretty remarkable. Sebastian Granger. So we'll be speaking with him. And then to switch things up a little bit, like I said, we will be hitting some of the same Dave Plyer elements because we are in for Dave Plyer, who we love very much, and we've had a lot of fun working with him in the past.
Nothing but love for Dave Plyer. We're both producers at one time for Dave Plyer, joining our friend Tom Hush and the great Walk of Fame, I guess you could say.
He definitely talks about you guys a lot.
Oh,
makes it hard for a guy coming up in the world. All right, can you just turn down the bright lights
so,
on you guys?
So Tom is a contrarian about us, apparently.
Oh yeah.
Well, good. We'll try to change your mind, Tom, on that.
We'll see.
Okay.
But then, stepping away from that, we have Eric Griffin.
Yeah.
Great comedian. We talked to him, a couple days ago, and we had so much fun with the interview. His new special, which is escaping me, but we talked about it in the interview. His new comedy special just debuted last night, I believe. But, he's in Workaholics. That's kind of where he got his big fame. Mm-hmm. And now he's also in I'm Dying Up Here, that great Showtime comedy series. I don't know if you want to call it a dark comedy. Like, what would it be?
It's a darker comedy. Like, people refer to it often as a dramedy.
Dramedy. Okay, so there's the buzzword. That's another thing I'm going to put on my contrarian list.
Buzzwords in general. Yeah. Buzzwords. But the cool thing about Eric and what he's doing with the comedy scene is he's a genuine guy. I mean, he went there to the comedy stores, and he did the open mics. He put in a lot of years, and now he's actually reaping these benefits from his hard work, which I love hearing about these comedians from Chicago. Well, not from Chicago, but these comedians who really, put themselves out there and then actually can reap these benefits.
Yeah, and one thing that I really love talking to Eric about, which again we will be speaking, I think we're gonna play that after the 2:30 news. Mm-hmm. But we talk about because there was a point in his career where, and he wasn't in comedy, he was just doing it as a hobby. Mm-hmm. But he up and left his day job and went and pursued it. So we were talking about pursuing the dream,
yes,
and the grind at the same time. And he talked about how the dream and the grind are kind of one and the same, which I love that idea.
I'd have to agree. I mean, we both work in show business, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I think so.
And it's definitely a grind. It's not. Of course, it's always fun. I always have a blast.
For sure.
But it is work when it comes down to it, and he explains that very well. And he's funny as heck. I mean, this dude deserves this.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And there was... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and if he comes to Chicago, I'd love to hang out with him and get him a pizza.
I love it, yeah. And there was one other thing I wanted to tease before we take a quick break here, but going back to that Sebastian Granger from Death from Above interview, he shared with us, and I know you know what I'm talking about, this... Probably one of the most rock and roll stories I've ever heard in my life.
It's the most rock and roll story, so, at least for the last 5 years or so like that. So be prepared for that.
Yeah, so I don't want to say too much, but it involves, we can say this, it involves bowling.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Bowling and rock and roll, I guess.
That's right.
I mean, we can't give away too much because I want you guys to enjoy it just as much as we did when he told this story. But that's going to be coming up at the 3:30 hour.
So, so with that said, let's take a quick break. Mm-hmm. So, again, we're at 312-981-7200, and Tom and Michael, get your contrarian thoughts ready because I want to hit this segment. And if you guys have anything that is universally loved, whether it's a movie or a restaurant or anything at all, call in 312-981-7200, call and text, and we will get our contrarian thoughts out there. So you are listening to Sound Sessions here on WGN Radio 720. Tom Hush with the ever thematic bumping music. I love it.
Guess cuts right to the point.
That's right.
Love it.
So like I was saying before we took that break, maybe I'm an opinionated individual. I don't know. But there are some things out there that I think are universally loved that I hate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You were
pretty heated about this. You were fuming at the ears before the show.
And again, I want to go through, like I said, so you buzzwords. Mm-hmm. I just decided I don't like them. I don't like buzzwords.
Not a fan of buzzwords.
Not a fan of the buzzword.
What do you not like about them? How buzzy they are? How many people use them?
Just talk to me directly. Don't use fluff language. That's how I feel about it. Again, we're at 312-981-7200. You can call and text. So what do you dislike that most people do enjoy or do like? So for example, like I said, also U2. They're on like a huge tour right now, which I think they like broke like some sort of sales record. I could pull up the story, but
yeah.
So obviously they're a very successful band.
They play nothing but arenas. They've been around for years. Everyone goes gaga over things like the Joshua Tree, their albums. And you know what the thing is? There was that huge backlash, and I think that everyone was a contrarian at one time when they put their music free on iTunes, and then everyone just lost their minds.
Oh, I just figured out how to take that off my iPhone and like 2-3 years removed, and I did it. I took it off just for the principle.
Wow.
Sorry, Bono. I don't want your music on my phone for no reason.
It was so funny because if you know, you go back and you look at the interviews post post backlash of that album, and it's just Bono sitting there, and he says, you know, I just wanted to have everyone have the album and have free music. I thought it was a good thing. And everyone just couldn't get any less of it. It was amazing.
So, you know, it's our perception that everybody loves U2, but let me ask you, who's in U2? Who are the members?
Yes. We got Bono.
Bono.
Singer.
You got The Edge. The Edge. Which, oh, come on. And then who else?
Close to the Stoop. And Tom.
Okay, so it's Bono.
Do you actually know this?
Yeah, totally.
Okay.
It's Bono, The Edge.
Some older
Adam
guy.
Adam Clayton Jr. Or it's Adam Clayton and Larry Mullins Jr.
That's the drummer and bassist?
Yeah.
Okay.
The guys that nobody knows who they are.
See, I like those guys better because they actually have real human names.
And they don't say anything.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Edge. What is that? Come on. Don't call yourself The Edge with those glasses.
You know, he's The Edge. He's a white guy with a beanie. I mean, what more edgy can you... Can you really get down to, right?
I think back in the 80s, it was kind of edgy, you know?
Yeah.
It was pretty edgy.
I remember there was a VH1 special on, like, the guitar and, like, Guitar Year that came out. And the individuals they featured were Jimmy Page,
mm-hmm.
Jack White, and then The Edge. And I'm thinking, the first two were cool, but why why? Of all, you know what I mean?
And that's a good point, because if you think about the greatest guitarists of all time, it's the people who changed the amplifier sound when there was no other way that they could even create that, or if they played their guitar upside down and because they needed to, they couldn't afford the right kind of left-handed guitar. But The Edge just chips away, and his pedal plays like echoed repeat.
See, I think that's what their thought was, is because he likes to play with the pedals, but so do, you know, thousands of other guitar players that are much better.
Yeah.
So, anyway, moving on from YouTube.
I was going to say, have you looked at Royal Blood and the bands that are out today?
Serious, yeah. But here's another one that I'm not a big fan of, and maybe Tom, I know you're a film guy. I don't like the acting work of Clint Eastwood.
Oh, get out of here.
I do not like...
Are you serious?
I am dead serious.
I've got a big Clint Eastwood poster in my room. It's him in The Outlaw Josie Wales, and just sitting there, you know, guns drawn, sitting there real mean.
He's always looks like he's got, like, he's in a sandstorm, and he's real squinty, and he's, what are you doing?
Get away from my Gran Torino.
get off my lawn.
I'm not a huge film guy, so I can't speak to all his works. I know as a director, he's pretty successful, but
sure.
As an actor...
Go back and watch the good, the bad, and the ugly, and tell me that isn't the swarthiest man you've ever seen on film.
Okay, fair enough. Another one, and again, if you guys have any, feel free to jump in.
Mm-hmm. I like to hear you dish out the hate for a little bit. You're such a positive guy. It's nice to hear this.
So I think only because it's very timely right now.
Okay.
Fireworks.
Oh yeah, no.
I like fireworks. But not when it's like, you know, the Saturday 4 or 5 days removed mm-hmm. from 4th of July and they're still blowing up in my neighborhood. There's got to be a little window of like, okay, it's okay to fire off fireworks. Maybe a day before,
mm-hmm.
maybe a day after. But come on, like, get it out of your system on the 4th of July.
Yes, if you're still rocking the residual fireworks for a long time after this, I mean, you put them away, soap them in water, and never light them off.
They're illegal anyway.
Thank you.
My finger is pointed to the air right now.
You look very...
I'm pushing up my glasses.
They're illegal. You can't spur them. Don't put them off on your hands either, because that's a very dangerous thing to do. I could see the fireworks thing, because it gets a little bit annoying. And if you're living in Chicago, you often don't know if it's a gunshot or a firework.
That's true.
I'm trying to keep people safe.
Right. And then maybe one more I have that's probably the most controversial. The Beatles. Now, it's not that I don't like the Beatles, but I don't like all the praise they get, because I don't think it's... fair to give them all of it. I think they're a good band. I think they were talented musically. Mm-hmm. I think they definitely paved the way for a lot of different techniques and other bands. But with the argument that always comes up, the most influential band of all time, no. They are not the most influential band of all time. They're in the discussion.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I would say the Velvet Underground was more influential.
You've heard
that Brian Eno quote. Not many people bought the Velvet Underground and Nico, but everyone who did started a band.
You know what? For the Velvet Underground, I did try to get into that band for a while, but that guy's, I mean, Lou Reed's voice, man.
I love it.
Oh, it's so weird and sultry.
But I'm a big fan of Neil Young, and I like the un you know, it's the uncommonly beautiful voice where it doesn't, it's not, you know, what you've heard before, but it still kind of strikes a chord.
Yeah.
But,
well, I think the a collective hush, not Tom Hush, but a collective hush went over the crowd when you said you didn't get the Beatles.
It's not that I don't get, well, here's the thing. I've really, because I feel like I'm a music guy, I'm a musician. I feel like I should like the Beatles. And I have tried my damnedest. I have tried to get through like all of their, they have a lot of music. Tried to get through all of it. I just can't. I can't. Like, there's some songs I like, but personally, I like their solo works as they all branched off and did their own stuff. I like it better.
Okay. And that's fair to say.
Who I would throw in the most influential would be Led Zeppelin. More influential than the Beatles.
You know what? I was thinking about this over this weekend, and I was thinking about music and how it relates to my own life and how it relates to just America in general and their influence. 60s set the melody. 70s was all rock and roll. You'll never find any more rock and time than the 70s. Led Zeppelin, we had Deep Purple. I mean, bands that were
Sabbath.
Just
Sabbath. They set metal.
I would put Sabbath in the discussion as well as more sure. influential. I don't know if you can edge out Beatles with Sabbath, but they're in the discussion. Mm-hmm. But
You know what? Another thing about the Beatles is they work so hard to create all that sound. And, like, talk about doing a lot of work in the clubs in Hamburg from creating, you know, your album when we didn't even have stereo set the way that we do now. It was all made on mono.
I know. So, they invented feedback.
Like they invented feedback.
They've done some cool things.
They invented feedback.
Sure.
They invented the reverse solo, too.
Where you, like, play it in reverse. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And we got some good news, though, too. Paul McCartney actually just this past month just collectively took back all of the Beatles licensing.
Yeah, good for him.
Which is good. That's finally. Cool. Goodbye, Michael Jackson. It's all Beatles.
What do you guys have as a contrarian? I think, Tom, you're an opinionated guy.
So one big one. I'll start with being a film guy. I absolutely hate Forrest Gump. I think Forrest Gump is one of the most overrated movies I've ever seen. It is such a boring love letter to like the late 20th century, and I feel like the message of that movie is either you can be an idiot and stumble through life and meet all these famous people and everything is fine, and also if you're a single liberated woman you will get AIDS and die.
Yeah, that's pretty
bad. That's the message of Forrest Gump.
Still has the feel good ending a little bit.
It does, but like when that came out and for the 94 Oscars. You have to look at what was up for Best Picture. Forrest Gump, Pulp Fiction, Quiz Show, might not have been Shakespeare in Love, but then Four Weddings and a Funeral. All these great movies.
Wow.
Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah.
It beat out all those movies. And there is no way Forrest Gump is better than Pulp Fiction or Shawshank Redemption.
It's troublesome to holding it up. And Pulp Fiction, one of my greatest, one of the greatest films of all time. Quentin Tarantino has just revolutionized directing and just the way that movies are made. But you got to admit, at the time, didn't Forrest Gump have like that great feeling? I mean, you were going through a certain time in America where you wanted an uplifting thing, and also it was the first time that they used that green screen in such a way where it made it look like he was shaking the hands of everybody. Come on,
that
was pretty cool, Tom.
It was awesome.
They've got him on with John Lennon on the talk show, and he's just like, "Wow, I really like you, Forrest Gump," and it's like very clearly fake.
That's the same series where he is in the White House and tells Kennedy he needs to go pee.
Brilliant. And he meets LBJ and
I drank about 21 Dr. Peppers during that time.
He may have had diabetes.
Great movie. Okay, well, let me give you mine real quick.
Please.
Along the lines of, you know, theater and movies, mainly theater. The play Hamilton. What's the deal with it? Why is everyone so on board with this for the last few years? I mean, granted, it's probably a fantastic play.
I haven't seen it. I'm not a musical guy in general, but yeah, I'm right there with you.
Yeah, the hype was too high, and now it's just it's like bubbled over the cup that I can no longer see this play because I'm afraid that I'm going to see it, pay $150 for it, come back to my friends and say that sucked.
Well,
so
I think maybe I'm just getting old and crotchety, but like I'm of the mindset now where it's like if it hits a certain price and I can actually see it on TV or like watch it online somewhere from the comfort of my own couch, well then yeah, I'm gonna do that instead.
So you're saying okay, you have let's say Super Bowl tickets, last row, you're sitting on a metal plate, or you can watch it at home. What are you gonna do?
Well, I think any NFL game, pretty much. Like you look at the Chicago Bears, who are down in the dumps, and their ticket prices are going up. You're better served watching a football game from home And anyway, you have your dip right there. You're not paying $10 a beer.
Yep.
You're inside in your warm home because typically, you know, it's cold and snowy on the lake there. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, those experiences, I'm not a, you know, people have FOMO, fear of missing out. Not me. Don't have that.
You just, the FOMO part of your body is just gone.
I have fear of missing couch. I really do.
Well, let's take a text real quick from the 630. The Clint Eastwood kind of erupted a little bit in our text world here. And from the 630, the Clint Eastwood movie Unforgiven is 10 out of 10. If you disagree, just ask Nick DiGilio, the great host here on WGN, and you probably don't want to argue with Nick D.
No, I mean, I won't.
Our resident movie expert.
That's right. Fair enough. I guess, yeah, I ruffled some feathers. I got the vibe from Tom. It was like, I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed when I said Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, mainly.
All right, well, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we are going to air our interview with the very funny Eric Griffin. You are listening to Sound Sessions here on WGN. You're listening to Sound Sessions here on WGN Radio. Before we go to the newsroom, I got a couple texts I wanted to air, you know, items I wanted to get in from the 708. I hate to admit it, but I'm 54 years old and have never seen any of the Star Wars movies. Just not interested.
Oh, man.
That's big.
Because he's in the age group for, or he or she is in the age group for Star Wars. You should be into that a little bit.
You know, I can relate with him, though. I have not. I saw the first one of the newest to come out, and it was okay. I was a little disappointed. I have no desire to see the rest now.
You know what? You're exactly right, Kevin. It's the same. It's like, how much more do we got to see of the same kind of like lightsaber, like Shabazz, you know, you're just talking to aliens kind of like thing. But, you know, we do have to cleanse the palate a little bit. We got our friend Craig here. What's going on, Craig? Welcome to Sound Sessions.
Hi. Thanks.
So, Craig, is there something you're a contrarian about? What don't you like?
It's got to be reality TV shows.
Reality TV shows.
Oh, all right. Any specific ones that you can come to mind?
Like the Survivor kind of stuff.
Oh, I love the Survivor stuff. I just like garbage TV. That's just me. But
it's so great because you can just sit on your couch, sink in there, and then just like let the whole world go around you. Craig, you know, I love that because I think that we can all agree reality TV kind of can suck sometimes.
Nope. I'm a contrarian to that idea.
Such a contrarian to that. And for that, Craig, hey, man, what do you think about going to open air the next weekend?
That would be awesome. Thank you.
Awesome, man. Do you have any favorite bands that you want to check out there?
Yeah. Actually, it's Stone Sour. That's the band I like to check out.
Oh, nice.
Out.
Yes.
Stone and Sour.
Did I say Stone and Sour? Oh, my gosh.
That correct.
I don't know, somebody did.
Well, that's fantastic. You're going to have a great time there. We're going to give you two tickets to the Chicago Open Air Festival happening at Toyota Park. A great thing. All the best metal bands, all the best rock bands. Craig, have a fantastic time this weekend, and thank you for listening to Sound Sessions.
Craig, stay on the line, and Tom will get all your info.
All right, thanks, guys.
Thank you. Well, let's without further ado, go up to the newsroom with Roger Badish.
Hey, this is Eric Griffin, and you're listening to Sound Sessions.
Welcome to another episode of Sound Sessions. This is Michael.
And this is Kevin.
And you know our next guest from his masterful portrayal of Montez on Workaholics, his new Showtime show, I'm Dying Up Here, as Ralph. And he just came out with a new stand-up special on Showtime, The Ugly Truth. We welcome Eric Griffin to the show. What's going on, Eric?
Good to be on with you guys. And Mike, you sound like you're on like the jazz radio right now. That was like very... That was almost very sultry the way you said that.
You know, we like to set the bed very calmly. Yeah, of course. So what's going on, Eric? Your career is just taking off by leaps and bounds right now. What's it feel like right now to have not only the stand-up special but have the show and the end of Workaholics, which was such a big hit? How's life right now?
You know, life is good. I mean, the thing about the entertainment business is once you get, like, a little bit of exposure, people think you came out of nowhere. You know what I mean?
But, right.
You know what I mean? It was, like, 7 years of Workaholics, and then I did Blunt Talk while I was doing that. And to jump onto another show, and such a different show, too, because, you know, Workaholics is, like, you're supposed to be drinking and smoking weed when you watch that show. You know, this show is completely different. So what I appreciated the most is just like the evolution, you know, just as myself as an actor and, And just being able to, like, achieve these things. Like, now I had a half hour, now I have an hour. So awesome. I just feel like I'm on the right path on the marathon of the comedy business. Right. You know what I mean? So it feels good.
For sure. In fact, I'd like to hear about it a little bit, kind of your path and your story. I mean, I'm reading here that you decided in 2003 to up and quit your job, which I'm curious what you were doing before comedy. And I guess what made you make the switch completely? I mean, that's an exciting move. So what kind of led up to that?
Well, you know, it's like what led to it is that I was living in fear. That's really what it was. You know, it's like trying to be a comic was like a pipe dream, you know, and
yeah.
I didn't necessarily have any mentors or anybody telling me, hey, follow your dreams and no matter what. So it took me some time to be a little older to realize, hey, I didn't want to wake up 50 and be like I didn't follow my dreams. You know, I didn't want to be a slave to things I didn't need, like car payments and house notes and, getting into some relationship that has forced me to do things that I didn't want to do. So I just really soul searched, and it was like time to like really make it happen. You know, I had a little bit of savings, and my mom's very supportive. You know, I'm a proud mama's boy, and you know, so I just took the plunge. You know, and soon after, I got a commercial agent, and I was getting some gigs, and then I was in the Seattle Comedy Contest, and then, you know, I found my first manager who I did like a Showtime. It was called the Payaso Comedy Slam. It's so funny that I did that on Showtime, and then now all these years later, I'm doing a Showtime special.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then things just started to happen. I did that in 2006. I had that first TV appearance, and then 2008, I did Live at Gotham, and that's where I met my first agent, who started getting me on the road. You know, then I did New Faces at Montreal, and then in 2010, I auditioned for Workaholics, and boom. The rest is history, as they say.
Well, it's awesome. You know, a lot of times we're talking to bands and musicians, but we've also talked to other guys, you know, other we actually talked to Andrew Santino not all that long ago. But, you know, the resounding theme here is that, yeah, you're like living the dream kind of, but you're also grinding your butt off. And that seems to be the overall theme for these guys that we talk to about pursuing their dreams.
You know, I actually think that actually is the dream. For me, the dream is that I can continue to work.
That's pretty cool.
I mean, you know, you want to be if you want to be an actor, it's not like win an Oscar or win an Emmy or be in a big movie. I think it's you want to be one of those people that's in the business, you know, that you're continuing, that, you know, you're just like, oh, he's in another thing. Oh, there's that guy. People know who you are, and they admire what you do, and they recognize you for what you do. I mean, I think that's really the dream, is to be like, you know, you're working, you're in that echelon of, working actor, working comedian. So that's really the dream that I'm living.
Right on. Yeah, it's so true. You know, there's a lot of passion that goes into your art form, and you can really see that through. Actually, I had seen you – I saw you at I got to change my language there. I saw you perform at Zany's here in Chicago, and I know you come back here a lot, and the audiences obviously must have grown over the years. You know, you give a very sincere kind of impassioned stand-up set. I mean, it's hilarious, of course, but how do you translate, you know – being the real Eric Griffin on stage when people are, you know, are going there maybe expecting to see someone like Montez on stage? How do you translate that?
You know
work?
What? That's the thing, is I feel like I'm surprising people. That's what I think is happening.
Yeah.
I love when people come up to me and go, oh my God, that I didn't expect that.
That's
you know,
cool.
I didn't, you know, I'm a fan of you now as well as a fan of Montez, you know, so that's always very, and I just do me, man. You know, it's like, I love stand-up because I don't ever let things go. So it's the perfect art form for someone that doesn't let things go. Because I get to talk about the same thing every night at the same intensity. You know, that's actually a gift that most men would love to have. Because, you know, when you have a relationship, you know, you go home and you might say, oh, this, let me tell you what happened today. She's going to listen one time. But you start to talk about it again, it's going to be like, okay, heard it already. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, but me, I get to share my pain and my how I feel with the audience every night. So it's good, and it's a little, you know, it's actually a little crazy too if you really think about it.
For
so
sure.
it is a passionate art form. It's a great way to say it, but you know, it does something to you. So that's why you need to have all these other outlets, and that's what I appreciate about, you know, being able to act and, you know, being able to, like, you know, do podcasts and have hobbies and, you know, things like that, and travel and I'd really be that case.
That's really great stuff. So I want to hear about, you know, some of these people you're actually working with throughout your storyline here. Some Chicago homeboy or hometown favorites, rather, with Andrew Santino Anders. You know, Anders is an Evanston guy.
Mm-hmm.
But talk about, like, some of these huge names and the relationships on set you're having with these guys like Anders and Andrew Santino and Jim Carrey even. I mean, what's that like to be working with guys like that?
It's incredible.
You know, it's first of all, starting with the Workaholics boys, you know, they're not, I don't think they're going to get, they're not getting enough credit for the chemistry that they have.
Right.
They really are the modern day Three Stooges.
That's a good way to put it.
You know, it's like they're actually one character, and they do it so well that this thing that they create that, you know, I really, that's really what was the heart and soul of what made Workaholic so great. And so working with them and watching them grow was inspiring too. And, you know, and we're friends, you know, these guys are my friends. You know, I talk to them. Adam and I are really good friends. You know, we got season tickets to the Clippers together.
You guys are always posting photos at like front row there at the Clippers games. It looks awesome.
Yeah. We're always at the Clipper game. And like, we talk about Clippers a lot. You know, I follow their careers, and it's like, and then my girls, Jillian and Mary Beth Monroe, Jillian Bell. And you know, Jillian's blowing up, and you know, we keep in contact, and it was like a really, you know, we had our ups and downs of being a low-budget show, but other than that, it was like, you know, it was great working with them. And then you switch to something that's so dramatic, like I'm dying up here, and I actually love every single person on that show. Mm-hmm. And we actually keep in contact almost every other day. We have a chat group, and we're texting each other, and we're talking about the show, and we're talking smack to each other, and we have a real good rapport. You know, Andrew Santino is now one of my best friends. You know, Mike Agliano and Clark Duke and all the guys on the show, Jake Lacey, Ari Grainer, Melissa Leo put me in another movie. She produced a movie that she gave me a part in because of meeting her on I'm Dying Up Here.
So cool.
And then, like, and then having, when Jim Carrey's around, when we do press kind of stuff, you know, he makes us feel like we're with him, you know. Mm-hmm. I think he feels comfortable with us, and I always appreciate that because, you know, he's going through all the things that he's gone through, and, you know, for him to be able to, like, sit with us and just, like, you know, act like a peer is amazing because, you know, he's had such an amazing career, so I'm enjoying. And then I worked with like Patrick Stewart on Blunt Talk, and that was great. Like,
no kidding.
He's such an awesome. You guys, people don't know how awesome he is. Like, I sent him an email after I saw Logan, and he got right back to me with a very, like, with a great response of just like, Eric, thank you for, you know, and he's just a great dude. So I've had the opportunity to like work with so many great people, and I just go, this is what I was saying earlier. I am literally living the dream.
Good for you, man.
Yeah, it makes me really happy to hear somebody, you know, who works so hard actually, you know, pull through and get to where you're at. Working with people like Patrick Stewart and Jim Carrey and all these fantastic names are just so well known. You know, you got to think, this is your moment with them. What kind of inspiration or what kind of wisdom are you grabbing from them? Did you have any good stories or anything that you heard from Jim or Patrick Stewart that's kind of stuck with you and you're kind of using, you know, in your day-to-day acting?
Yes. One of the things, like, with Patrick Stewart is, like, how professional he is. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, you know, when you're on a set, like, sometimes you do, you know, they're doing coverage. So you'll do your coverage and then, you know, they turn around and you're not on camera, but you're there reading the lines so the other person can react to someone. Some actors don't do it, you know? Some actors, like, especially the bigger ones, they walk away. They have a stand-in do it. Or this guy, he's there. You know, it's important to him that he is giving you that same energy even when he's not on camera. And he's like a great storyteller. It's funny. My funny thing about Patrick Stewart is he loves to tell stories about, like, you know, theater, you know? And I was asking him, like, well, did you ever have a bad experience? And so, and then he started to tell me, like, he was doing, like, Hamlet or something. And he mentioned it in a way like, you know, I was doing that scene from Hamlet, and I didn't know what he was talking about. So I had to pretend. I was like, oh, yeah, I know that scene. You know? And then he proceeds to tell this whole great story about it. And he's just like, it just was like, I was just so fascinated to just be sitting here like this is Patrick Stewart and he's talking to me about his life and and working hard at his age and he's still going at it. And it just, that was inspiring to me. Like, hey, I want to be doing what he's doing at his age. You know what I mean? So, and it's the same thing like with Jim Carrey. He took the cast to dinner and was telling stories of the Comedy Store, and he was telling stories about like when he first moved here and wow, how he had to live in a closet and you know, how he, his first sitcom, he thought he was going to be a star and it didn't work out, and and the trials and tribulations of his whole career to get to the point where he's at now, and just like looking at that, and you make it feel like it's possible. You know, like nothing was just handed to any of these people.
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm on that path. I'm on the road, and I'm going to wake up one day and maybe somebody will be talking about me the way I'm talking about them.
Seeing you on the big screen or on the TV screen compared to Eric Griffin on stage, what is the difference there? What can people expect?
Well, you know, the thing is, like, my comedy is basically, to me, comedy is, here's what I think's funny. So I have to show you why I think this is funny. And then you're going to agree or disagree with laughter. So, you know, it's just how my brain works. It's like, this is how I think about certain things. This is how I think about online dating. This is how I think about, you know, so, could I tell a story about my mom in the special? My mom's a little bit crazy, you know.
Okay.
But, you know, and it's just like, and I want to tell you why I think this. And then I just have a way about myself that, you know, it just I try to suck you in with, you know, my humor and my vulnerability. So that's the kind of thing you're going to see when you watch my special. And I just, and it's like, just enjoy it. You know, I just want people just to watch and just, we're living in such like crazy times right now, you know, with the president and everybody that likes him and dislikes him and North Korea and everything that's happening every single day on the news. And sometimes it's time to take a little escape. So turn to Showtime and just go, huh, let me just forget about all this and just laugh.
That's perfect.
Really what is needed. You know, it's a break. It's a respite from all the nonsense of your life, you know, through the weird mind of myself, Eric Griffin.
And you can catch that on Showtime tonight. Make sure you do. And make sure you stream it, too, if you can get it on Showtime as well.
Switching gears.
Yeah, switch gears.
So a lot of times, Eric, when we're like I said, we're a comedy podcast typically. So I'm sorry, a music podcast, rather. And I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, what are you listening to these days?
You know what? I'm actually listening to a lot of jazz these days.
Okay.
Started dating this lovely lady, and she, you know, she likes jazz, and I love the fact that she liked jazz. So I, like, you know, I got my Sirius radio, and I just like, I turn on the, you know, the Seriously Sinatra station, and I go at it. But because that's the kind of music you can listen to all day.
For sure,
that's the kind of music. That's the kind of music that I like. Now I like a lot of music. Like, I like hip hop, but I can only listen to that for like 45 minutes to an hour,
okay,
and then I'm like, I got to turn this crap off. You know what I mean?
Right.
And then, you know, or, and then I also like to listen to, let's say, like, you know, those like easy listening, like, you know, the hits from today in 2000s, you know, you know what I mean? I love those kind of like alternative rock stations.
Yeah.
And because you can listen to it all day and it's kind of relaxing, you know, but you know, that kind of song is like, I don't want to wait for my love to be over, you know, just. I can hear that all day,
okay,
but then I want to have, like, I'll have a time when I'll turn to the country station because I love country music, too, because I love the stories. Country music reminds me of a long stand-up story, you know?
Yeah.
They'll have something about the dog and the truck, and they'll just be like, you know, and then I'm driving down the road. You know, I love all that kind of stuff. So I have my moments where I like to listen to a lot of different types of things. And then, of course, you know, I also have, like, on my Spotify, I got the Billboard 100 because I want to hear what are people listening to, what's hot right now.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Let me hear what, you know, what's going on. So, you know, I get my Jay-Z and I'll listen to Katy Perry. You know, I'm all over the place, man. I wish I could say I love this one specific thing, but
no,
that's pretty much me. I'm pretty eclectic music taste.
I think that's good to be that way.
Yeah, you keep yourself open to, you know, any possibilities, which is really nice. So along those lines, Eric, what was your first concert, a music concert, and then what was your first stand-up like show that you went to when you were younger?
My first music concert was the Victory Tour. was Michael Jackson at Dodger Stadium.
Wow, that's a big one.
Come on.
Yeah, man. I was like, you know, and I look back on it, I go, I would suggest to everyone listening right now, if you have a person that you love their music, go see them live, because you will regret not doing
it. Right.
You know? And so I always remember that, because that was at the height of his power. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That was like 84. And it was like coming off of Motown 25 and just that energy at Dodger Stadium, seeing him like do that. I always remember that. You know, I saw Madonna a couple years ago, and I was like, it was great. But I was like, oh, I wish I would have seen 25-year-old Madonna.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
You know what I mean? Because Grandma Madonna's still good, but it's not the same. You know what I mean?
For sure.
So I remember that. I've seen Michael Jackson, and then I saw Janet Jackson a few times.
That's cool.
And then ever since then, I've been going to a lot of different types of concerts. I love watching, I like doing it, and that's why I suggest people do it. My first comedy show, I actually didn't get into comedy until my first comedy show was the first time I did comedy, at a comedy club.
Really?
You know, I took comedy class, and then the showcase for the comedy class was at the Comedy Store. And after our show, the real comics went up, and I was like, oh, wow, this is how it really is. So that's the first time I really went to a comedy show. But I regret not going to like those kinds of things. Like, I wish I wish I would have seen Cosby, you know,
in his prime.
Before all this, like, you know, sure. maybe that's why I didn't see him, you know, but you know, it's like Eddie Murphy, Richard, like, you know, Eddie Murphy was like my main inspiration when I was a kid, just watching Eddie Murphy. And I wish I would have seen him live. I wish I would have gone to, like, when he was, like, making comedy, like a rock star, you know? Mm-hmm. So I really, like I said, I can't stress it enough. If you're listening to this, you know, check out where the people you admire, the people that you listen to, the people you think are funny. You need to go out and watch them live. It's such a tremendous experience.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, that translates a lot to the show that you're on, the I'm Dying Up Here on Showtime. I just saw the Richard Pryor episode when he's kind of mentoring RJ's character.
No spoilers. I haven't gotten anywhere yet.
No spoilers.
No spoilers.
but I'm,
hey,
I'm,
it's already been out, man. You're one of those people that waits like 8 weeks and then you're telling everybody, no spoilers.
I know. It's like we want to talk about it.
You get 10 days, buddy. You get 10 days and then it's spoilers.
That's fair.
but seeing something like that, you know, Richard Pryor, who was at the store at the time, and seeing him at the height of his power when he could just walk in and the whole place just goes absolutely nuts. I mean, that would have been really cool to see him like at on the Sunset Strip or something like that. That'd been so awesome.
You know what? I got to tell you guys, if people that are in L.A., if you come to L.A., you know, you got it. Like the Comedy Store right now is jumping like that right now. I mean, every night it's like Joe Rogan's there, Chris D'Elia is there, you know, Chris Rock is always popping in when he's in town. You're going to see Bill Burr. You're going to see it all on one lineup.
It's crazy.
That stuff's happening right now, you know. So, like, even, like, in locally, like, it's like in, you know, Chicago, it's like you got to check and see what's going on at the different clubs, at the Improv, at Zany's, you know, everywhere that they do comedy, because you'll be surprised who's going to be in town. And you got to get out there and see them, because it's different. Live stand-up comedy is not the same as recorded for, like, TV. It's not the same.
Right.
You know, there's something, you know, something corporate about it. You know what I mean? With all the lights and, like, get the other of the censorship, depending on what network it's on.
Yeah.
So go see people live. I mean, I can't stress that enough. Come see me live. Go to ericgriffin.com and find out when I'm coming to your town.
There you go.
I was just going to say, Eric, what's on the plate next for you? I mean, you're doing so much already. What can we expect next from Eric Griffin?
Well, I'm hoping we get a season 2 of I'm Dying Up Here.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, I'm just going to start touring around. Like, I'm going to Seattle soon. I'm going to the Montreal Comedy Festival, JFL. I'm going to be there doing shows. And it's like summer camp for comics. I love it.
Cool.
And then I'll also be in Tampa. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I said, on my website, ericgriffin.com, I got all my upcoming dates, and the calendar keeps filling up. You know, so we'll see what happens, especially after tonight, see if people, if they really like me.
That's ericgriffin.com. We're speaking to the man himself.
So that kind of wraps up our interview with Eric Griffin. We're about out of time on that. But we're going to release it on WGNRadio.com as the full uncut interview. You guys can go on there and check it out, enjoy it. But yeah, coming up after the news here, we're going to be speaking with Tony Mikolaitis, the promoter for U2, David Bowie, and countless others. So stick around for that. Really great stories. But for now...
For now, this is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say, hey, play WGN. Hey, welcome to Sound Sessions. This is Michael.
And this is Kevin.
And Kevin, it's so interesting to think what goes on behind the music. You know, what happens with bands like Rihanna and U2, these enormous bands. How do they come to be, you know? It's super interesting. We have Tony Mikolaitis joining us on the phone right now. He was, in fact, he worked with some of the greatest groups of all time, from R.E.M., U2, David Bowie, Peter Gabriel. Come on, man. That's awesome. And he now uses his book, Insights from the Engine Room, to share stories about the music industry and how to work with top performers and kind of translate it to millennials today. And we welcome Tony to the show. What's going on, Tony?
Hi, guys. Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, thanks for joining us here on Sound Session. So I wanted to know, what goes into being a music promoter? I mean, when you're dealing with bands at this level, what kind of stuff, what kind of thinking goes into projecting a great group into an even better group?
Well, so much of it has got to do with the infrastructure within the artist. I mean, I always say you never find a great band without a great manager. There's so much to do that separates the artist from the artistic process, so to speak, that if they get... I mean, they have to know what's going on. For obvious reasons, they don't get ripped off and stuff and things. But they should really concentrate on what their skill set is, which is writing and performing and just becoming better and better, which is, of course, what U2 always did. Mm-hmm. But they're very much like a unit in as much as they've had this, apart from the last 2 years, they've had the same manager, pretty much the same crew, the same label, obviously the same lineup. I mean, you have to fetch, you no way will you find anybody alive today that's got the same lineup for 37 years.
Right.
So I think the thing with U2 is that I always find them as a great case study because in an industry like this where it's so fickle and you know, trends change and you work with one guy at a record label and all of a sudden they've moved on and someone else comes in, that they've managed to maintain that level of success for so long is quite incredible. So I quote them for a bunch of things, from opportunities and risks to mistakes, and also a great lesson in kind of keeping your staff, I suppose.
So, Tony, I'm kind of curious, you know, having been a musician before, I mean, not necessarily on any level near U2, of course, but I've done the thing, and I've gotten to the point where we decided, we made the conscious effort, okay, we're going to start treating this like a business. Mm-hmm. It becomes daunting, you know, and you were just saying, there needs to be a certain point where you decide as a band, okay, we need to stick to the music side of things. So I guess my question is, at what point should a band be looking for a manager and looking for a promoter and things like that?
Well, the interesting thing was U2 turned down a record deal or the opportunity to release a record, so to speak, and potential management because they weren't quite ready for it. But they did take a manager quite young, a guy called Paul McGuinness, who was destined for a career in films, and he actually got them the record deal and stuff. But one of the interesting things that people don't know about U2 is... you make a lot of money out of publishing. Obviously, every time a record gets played anywhere in the world, even on a jukebox or something, you get a cut of, you know, what amounts to a sizable paycheck when you're that big. But the interesting thing with U2 was they decided to share all the publishing right from the very beginning. Now, that's all right when you're preparing for the school disco. It's a good idea to do that because when the money comes in, and inevitably the kind of the bass player and the drummer might not be earning as much as the other guys, that splits so many bands up, you know. And
right.
But bands that I've had direct involvement with myself, because all of a sudden, it's kind of, why are you getting all the money? But it's really getting your house in order from the beginning. And U2 were great at the business of U2, as well as you being a band, obviously, because if you distance yourself from that and you allow people... invariably, it's an industry surrounded by greed. And even bands like The Police and stuff who got ripped off in the early days. I mean, I don't know if this is relevant, but I mean, Leonard Cohen, who passed away last year, I mean, he ended up bankrupt, and Hallelujah kind of saved his career, but he was 70 at the time. His accountant had been embezzling money out of him for decades. And you wonder how that can happen, but people get really good at it.
I'm sure. Yeah, it seems to be there, if you figure out the game, there's a way to screw somebody at all times, I feel like.
Yeah. And I think, to be fair, I'm sure it happens in sport. I'm sure it happens in a lot of businesses where it attracts a certain type of person that is motivated purely by what's in it for me. And that's happened with managers. And so, I mean, if you look at the whole Lou Pearlman exercise with the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC, I mean, you know, the guy went to prison, but he went to prison like after he kind of, you know, ruined too many people's lives. And they become kind of self-obsessed with this kind of desire is the wrong word, almost like this morbid fascination about whatever it takes to get richer and richer and richer. Mm-hmm. Now, the bands did really well, but it's incredible the bands that can survive without counselling, because when you have that amount of pressure put on you and that amount of work rate that you do so much, because all the time the person's like one step ahead with knowing what needs to be done in order to create this. And, you know, the stories are I mean, Brian Epstein, for instance, way back when was great for the Beatles, but he did some really bad business deals. But, you know, you've got to kind of learn, and I don't suppose bands become as big as the Beatles quite as quick, and then to take that in. I mean, they're publishing, which was up for grabs for ridiculous amounts of money, even to the extent of Michael Jackson. I mean, I wonder what Paul McCartney felt when Michael Jackson owned his songs.
It's crushing. Oh, I'm sure that's insane. Did Paul ever get those songs back? I know there was kind of a debate, and I think that he's kind of gathered a lot of his catalog back. Did you hear anything about that, Tony?
I'm not absolutely sure, but I think it's kind of, you know, but you got to look at Paul McCartney, 75 now.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you feel he doesn't need the money, but it's kind of embarrassing to think, well, hang on, you wrote all these songs that are kind of anthems and hymns and, you know, and stuff, and you don't own them. How did that happen? And, of course, getting involved in it, it's almost kind of digging up stuff from the past that you don't want to remember. But I'm not quite sure, but I'm sure he's pretty much there or thereabouts, and he'll live.
Yes, I believe so. I believe so. And, you know, Tony, you mentioned something that's very interesting. I mean, I find the business of music so enthralling, the way that you can see we have these villains and heroes. Kevin, are you familiar with Lou Pearlman? And do you know
with the Serbian? Yeah.
He was behind NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, and he screwed them so royally that he went to jail for screwing these bands and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
To be at that level and to see that demise is just, you know, why not? What happened to the love of the music and everything, and what happened to, you know, finding the good promoter? Where does a band go to meet somebody like a Tony Mikolidis to see what their path is?
Well, good question. I think going back to your original question about wanting a manager, I mean, for instance, the industry's changed so much now. I mean, you used to sign to a record company for two things, basically: distribution and recording. Recording cost a lot of money because you had to do it in the studio, and you had to have a producer and an engineer, and they would spend $350,000 making a record, and then you spend a large portion of your next few records, unless you had a lot of success quickly, paying that back, because every single haircut to every single video to every single record that's pressed, the artist inevitably pays for. And then the other thing is distribution. Well, you have the internet for distribution now, so when I meet kind of young enthusiastic people along the way, I like to give them a reality check. Obviously, when you were in a band, it was a different time and a greater opportunity, because I'm all for people who want to be in a band to try it, because no matter where you go in your career and what you do, if you don't give it a go, you'll always at some stage in your life come back to it and thinking, I wonder if. And you have to do that from the creative kind of surge that you have. And I understand that. I mean, I don't write and I don't sing myself, but I kind of think like an artist, you know. It's kind of inbred into me. And I think managers are really important. The difficult thing with managers is what you don't want is the drummer's brother, the guy who can't get the band. who'll take care of business. I mean, funnily enough, I was that person. I was in a band myself. I played bass particularly bad.
Okay.
I wrote about it a little bit in my book, actually. And I said, but I managed to get the gig quite easily because I had the largest kind of spare room to rehearse in. Mm-hmm. And my mum used to bring us scones and coffee.
It was sold. That's great.
Yeah, hey, I'll play this. Don't turn it up too loud and we'll kind of cover for everything else. But then when I kind of left the band, I managed them. And it was the best job in the world. Well, not the best job financially, but my job was to get gigs and to try and get a record deal, and we didn't get either. So I wasn't a very good manager. I did actually manage later on a little bit, because management is about connections. So mm-hmm. it's very difficult to get a successful manager. I mean, for instance, Paul McGuinness, who managed you to manage PJ Harvey, and Chrissy Hynde, the Pretenders, for a while, but he didn't do as good a job as he did with U2. But when you've got a band of that stature internationally mm-hmm. that are known throughout the world, you can't really take your eye off the ball. Because if you do, then there'll be gripes and people complaining within the band. So if you try and get a manager of any kind of kudos and credibility and such and successful manager, it's very hard to get because he's likely to be managing a successful act and he won't have the time. So you pick somebody else up who will try and try and try. And the other thing is with the way the industry has changed is so much of it is reliant on the artists managing themselves. I mean, they should get on social networking. They should build up their core fan base. I mean, when I was working with U2, mm-hmm. and I'm talking when they were playing to like 30 people. I mean, I've seen them play to like 11 people in a pub in Manchester, and three of those people came with me.
Wow.
Every single night they played, they would go backstage and they would kind of, there was no facilities as such. They had some towels to wipe themselves down, you know. So they'd go back after playing some really sweaty dive bar or whatever. And this was pretty much seven nights of the week. And then they'd kind of have 10 minutes and then they'd come out and they'd meet every single person who wanted to meet them.
Who'd
stay behind and literally to the state of the commissioner at the end of the night saying, listen, guys, you've got to go. We've got to wrap up. You know, we've got to turn the lights off. But they would do that every single night without fail, wherever they were and however tired they were. Could you imagine somebody like Bono now going back to like the hotel or sitting in the bar and going on social networking? The amount of fans he would get in Japan, in Australia,
yeah.
All they could do was meet the people in Manchester and Birmingham and London that they played to on the night. Like right. 20, 30 people, maybe five people. Now you can go to bed and make like five fans in Japan, wake up and you've got 50 fans because they're all saying, hey, I met this great guy, you know, he's here, listen to this track and things. So social networking is such an important thing, and especially if you ever get anywhere near a record deal, because you have to have a reason for record labels not to be able to ignore you. And the only reason that can happen is that you've built a solid core fan base. You've put product out, you've sold a little bit of this, you've sold a little bit of that. Wherever you play, you have a core following of, you know, if you're out of town, X amount. If you play your hometown, you can get 400 or 500 people along. Then they can sit up. And you don't need a manager to do that because, right. I mean, people like, oh, God, what's his name? I can't remember. Anyway, successful artists would go and interact with their fans. I mean, people like Lady Gaga did it.
Yeah.
And it elevates them above a catalogue number. So certain things that have changed for an audience to feel that they have some of some sort of connection with the band, I think is really important.
Mentioned it earlier, but you said that the industry is changing. It seems like the music industry is in such flux right now with, you know, streaming here now. And I guess what I'm trying to get to is, how are record labels really making money now? What are the services they're providing for artists? And are they even really necessary anymore?
Well, it's a very kind of, it takes time to kind of sort it out. Let me say one thing. Even though I made my entire living out of the record industry, my job was an extension of my hobby, and I was fortunate enough to end up working with people whose records I'd bought as a kid. So as regards living the dream, that doesn't happen to some kid from the north of England. You know, I was fortunate enough that I got an opportunity. It was a job that I never really expected, that I would never let go. But in saying that, the record industry is a greedy beast. I mean, it took them a long time to realize that nobody was ever going to be as successful as the Beatles. But what happened was then the whole thing that happened in the 70s was the kind of aftermath of the 60s. There was excitement. People were getting bands together, and not just like the hair bands and all that, but, you know, people like Elton John came through and stuff like that, who became major artists for a long, long time. But what happened was that kind of, you know, went on and on and on. And then they had a period in the kind of late 80s, 90s, where, I mean, MTV came out in the 80s, and that helped sell a lot of records through people were making very expensive videos, you know, right. Michael Jackson, Duran Duran, Madonna, all these people came through MTV predominantly. And then the other thing was then CD came out. So all these people who'd kind of got married and bought cars and bought couches and furniture now had disposable income to spend on a new format because all their records were scratched. So that was incredibly, I mean, the record industry went to the artists and told them about this new format and persuaded them to take a lower royalty rate. Well, you don't have to be, it's not rocket science, guys. What's the most expensive cost in making a record? I mean, I mentioned it earlier, the recording.
Recording, right.
These records had already been made. They just took the masters and made another format. So they were creaming it in. And then when the internet came out, the interesting thing about the internet is David Bowie, who's a visionary in my mind and a lot of other people's, is saw what the internet was going to do for the industry so far ahead of anybody in the record industry. He knew it would change everything. He was the first artist to release a record on the internet. But the interesting thing was the record industry, David Bowie was the sort of guy when Napster came out would have called him up and said, hey, let's have lunch. You know, if he was running a record company, rather than we'll close them down.
Right.
Oh, the internet, that'll go away. Well, good decision that was. So Steve Jobs crept in.
Yeah.
And the greed in the record industry, and we've all been there. We've all bought records, should I say albums, which have got three or four songs that you maybe like and not the rest, but you had to buy the album. Mm-hmm. So they were making exorbitant amounts of money by selling albums to people who'd bought the two hit singles or whatever. And then the other acts that were allowed to develop and make albums that really sold to a core fan base. Then when Steve Jobs came in and approached the industry, they didn't want to know. You're going to sell singles for 99 cents. You've got to be joking. We're not doing that. Mm-hmm. And ends iTunes. And that was the end of that. So all of a sudden, people are having the opportunity to buy tracks and songs as opposed to the complete works, i.e. an album. And that changed everything, I think. And the other thing to remember is, irrespective of people like me, I mean, I'm proud to be a baby boomer, you know, but I grew up buying records. I wanted a job to buy records, make money to buy records and go to gigs. It wasn't that I didn't have any ambition. It was just that I can't stop this. I've got to have music in my life all the time. And I think, as you know, if we took like the millennial route, I mean, you have a generation of people going up that have never really had it to miss it. I mean, if they can get stuff like music for free, and then there's the streaming services like Spotify and Pandora and stuff, then how do you get them to pay for music? And where's the next Bob Dylan's and Paul Simon's and, you know, songwriters and stuff going to come from if it's not really going to be a very good job, if you can't make the amount of money that you could? And getting back to the question again, the record industry have something now going, which is creating a lot of friction, which is the 360-degree model, because they don't make as much money from selling records, but they want a piece of everything. Mm-hmm. Now, the piece of everything includes publishing, includes merchandise, includes live work. Well, that was the artist's, like, little kind of paycheck, because they owned all that. Mm-hmm. So now they try to eat into having kind of that, you know, and that's That I mean, they could never do it with people like U2 because they were too big and powerful. But with the smaller bands, if they sign them, they sign them for a piece of wherever they make money.
Yeah, it's truly astonishing to see all that goes into this. There's so many working parts at the same time. By the way, we're speaking to Tony Michaelides. You can check him out at TonyMichaelides.com. It's spelled just the way it sounds. Come on, everybody knows this. he has two books out. He is the Let the Good Times Roll, which will be coming out in the next 2 to 3 months, and Insights from the Engine Room. Tony, you know, there's another kind of aspect to music. It's the creation of the pop star that we've been seeing over the last 10, 15 years, you know, with the American Idols and The Voice and everything. And they're almost making these open micers into enormous celebrities. Now, I know you had a little bit of a connection with Simon Cowell. Can you speak on that?
Yeah. I mean, Simon Cowell, trust me, I've worked some of the worst records you've ever heard in your life at Simon Cowell.
Yeah.
But you don't hear of those because they're brushed under the carpet really quick. I mean, he went through a period. I mean, I have a line in my book that says when I first met Simon Cowell, he was 30. He'd been bankrupt twice and he was living with his parents, which is kind of a wow factor. Exactly, a wow factor, because you don't think kind of the most famous man in the world had a rough time.
Kind of gives Kevin and I hope. Yeah.
It gives us all hope, doesn't it? But the point was, Simon kind of started a label and it was doing well, and then it kind of went pear-shaped and that was the end of that. And BMG let him have some office space, and he eventually came good with a band in the UK that sold in Europe called Robson & Jerome. These were two guys that were on the TV on a Sunday night drama thing. He persuaded them to do a version of the Righteous Brothers, You've Lost That Loving Feeling, and they didn't want to do it.
Nice.
To the extent that one of them, he even had to put a restraining order on, because Simon Cowell was phoning him 4 or 5 times a day. And he even offered them like $1 million, I think, in the end, and if you didn't like it, I won't put it out. Anyway, it turned BMG that year, which was the late 90s, from a loss into a profit. It was that successful. They became BMG's biggest selling artist in that year throughout Europe. But what happened after that was he moved.
All right, so that's our interview with Tony Mikolaitis, the great concert promoter for REM, U2, David Bowie. We're going to have that full interview on WGNRadio.com. But until then...
Well, coming up, actually, we have Sebastian Granger coming up after the news of Death from Above, talking about the most rock and roll story I've ever heard in my life.
Oh, yeah. Make sure you stay tuned in, because we have one of the greatest rock and roll stories you'll hear, and you'll be very delighted by it. So yeah. Stay tuned.
Hey, this is Sebastian from Death from Above, and you're listening to Sound Sessions.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Sound Sessions. This is Michael.
And this is Kevin.
And we are so excited to be having Sebastian Granger from the great band Death from Above, 1979, but now they're just Death from Above. They're playing Summerfest on July 4th at 10 p.m., and they're going to be here at Riot Fest in September. We welcome Sebastian to the show. What's going on, man?
What's up?
Not too much, not too much.
So, Sebastian, I know we're promoting your appearances. You've got the new single, Freeze Me Out, which is awesome. Just listen to it, really dig it. But I got to get into a more pressing issue with you first.
Let's do that.
So, apparently, I got a friend I was talking to the other day, said, and I said, hey, we're talking to Sebastian Granger from Death From Above. Really excited. And he's a huge fan. And he said years ago, you put out on some sort of social media outlet, whether it was Facebook or Twitter or whatever, he said you put out a recipe for delicious ribs in the oven, and he lost it and doesn't know how to make them anymore. Do you remember this at all?
Yeah, I remember doing it, but I don't remember the recipe. It was probably some, you know what? There's a website called Mitten Kitchen. It's a really great food blog, and I was probably just ripping off all of my recipes from her at that point. So if he goes to Mitten Kitchen and searches for, you know, apartment or oven baked ribs or whatever.
Yeah,
that's probably where I stole them from.
So, are you a big do you get into cooking then?
Yeah, I enjoy cooking. I think it's like my dad was a pretty good cook, and he was the cooking role model in the house, and he was very, you know, improvisational. And I kind of, when I'm in the zone in the kitchen, it feels like music. That sounds kind of corny, but that's kind of how it is. More recently, I've been getting into baking bread, sourdough bread. I've been doing it like just over a year now, and just kind of getting good at it. I think I started with a bang and then got really cocky, and then screwed up a bunch. And now I'm at the point where I can, you know, I'm one with the dough. It's really fun. Yeah.
That's awesome.
One with the dough. What a great album name, too. So it's the summertime. Yeah. This is the perfect time to do these kind of things, like go out grilling, meet up with some friends. What's a typical summer day or just day in general of the life of Sebastian Granger? I mean, you're playing music, you're revving up for this tour. What's that day look like?
I mean, being in a band, I don't know how it is for other people, but for me, it's about, you know, 2 dozen different jobs that constantly require attention. So whether it's, you know, writing music or recording music or designing billboards or editing videos or, you know, there's just so many things that I end up doing in a day. So it's like a million jobs, you know. So I could bore you with all the different specific things, but you know, it's about 1,000. Yeah,
it never ends. It's always just like just working to get these things going. Now you're playing Summerfest. This is a huge festival, and you're hitting up a lot of these festivals this year. Mm-hmm. What is your draw to these? Do you like playing these big festivals? Are you more down to earth? Like, and are you looking to play some more smaller shows coming up this year?
I like both of those. I like both of them. I like playing. The bigger shows are fun because you're basically harvesting an audience. You know, you go to a festival and everyone's there to see a different band.
Yeah, yeah.
And what you hope to do, you know, what we hope to do is to you know, steal some fans or borrow. You know,
yeah, sure.
We played a festival a couple of years ago, and Flaming Lips were playing, and while other bands were playing, Wayne Coyne was marching around the festival grounds with like a parade, and he was literally stealing fans from other stages to go to the Flaming Lips show.
What?
I thought it was such a dick move. Anyway,
they're the Flaming Lips.
It's
you know. Yeah, I mean, the Flaming Lips are pretty big. They don't really have to, you know, go about it like that.
I mean, that's how they got big.
Sure.
Duplicitous behavior, you know.
Yeah. So Sebastian, I'm curious to know, I mean, because we've talked to a couple of other, like, the two-piece bands, like we talked to L-1011, we talked to Royal Blood, I'm sure we've talked to some other ones, but mm-hmm. do you find yourself feeling, like, a draw to those, or even maybe a bond with, like, fellow two-piece bands?
No. Why would I feel bonded to people just because they have the same amount of people in the band?
Well, I think it's a unique thing, you know? not every, you know, it's not a typical thing in music.
I guess so. That's what would be considered identity politics in the political debate these days.
Sure. Okay.
Which is like just identifying with the thing because you are the thing, and you know, no, I'm just being facetious. I don't really, you know, I would identify more. I did fight with bands musically, not just because they have, you know, a certain sound or a certain amount of people in the bands, you know.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, that's fair. You guys can just be on top of the mountain for all we know, because you guys are fantastic and the new sound is great. You know, I did want to know, you guys have such a really cool artistic background. I mean, you're talking about how many posters you're putting out, and you have that iconic artwork, that album art that you have for the last few years. I wanted to know, where did that artwork come from? Where was that inception? Because that's so grilled into my mind from being like a fan through the college years and high school listening to you guys. Where did that inception come from?
Well, we were, when we started out, we kind of came up in like the punk / hardcore scene.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really like a cool thing to put your face on a record cover.
Mm-hmm.
But when we started the band, we were like, you know, there was two people, it was very like, it felt very iconic already, so we were like, let's, you know, we wanted to do something where we were like on the cover of the record. And we were listening to Deep Purple in rock a lot of the time, and the cover of that record is the band's members' faces on Mount Rushmore. And so we were trying to kind of emulate that minimal, it's their faces, but it's kind of a sculpture. And Jesse came up with this idea. You know, it was kind of, I don't think he set out to do this specifically, but you know, he drew our faces with these elephant trunks, and it ended up being just like a very iconic logo type thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the goal was to make something akin to, you know, what the Ramones have or what the Misfits have, which is just something that is just emblematic of the band. You don't need to know, you know, people probably who've never heard the Misfits will wear a Misfits t-shirt, you know?
True, true.
So we weren't, you know, it wasn't like a marketing scheme, but it was something we wanted the image of the band to be as recognizable as music was. That's how it came up. And it was, you know, keep in mind, these are like early days when no one knew who we were. So that was the kind of foresight that we were operating at the time.
Well, you kind of, I will say a question we like to ask these artists often that we're interviewing, and you kind of just name drop some, and you kind of have done it for us, but we like to ask, what are you guys listening to? But I just stumbled upon your Spotify playlist, What We Are Listening To, and I have to comment on how eclectic it was, first of all, and the fact that you ended it with one of my favorite metal bands, Cult Leader, which is so aggressive and so in your face. I mean, it's masterfully done.
Yeah, that was all Jesse. I mean, I don't know how they ended up amalgamating the playlist. I don't know if they just put them together, but we each made a playlist, and I just basically picked a bunch of people I knew, like a bunch of bands that like I'm friends with.
That's cool.
And tried to populate it with all the people I knew, and then Jesse just went full like weirdo music, which is where his mind is at all the time. Yeah, I'm the funky one. He's the freaky one.
Well, I want to know too, to build on that, can you tell us what the first concert you ever attended was, and then also the first record that you ever felt like an impact from?
The first concert I ever went to, I'd go to smaller, you know, kind of local whatever shows with my folks when I was very young. But the first big, like, full-on concert I went to was the New Kids on the Block tour.
No kidding.
It was my sister's birthday, and my father had the morning of her birthday had bought four tickets to see the New Kids for her, and she freaked out so hard that she couldn't go. It was just like a debilitating excitement.
Oh my God.
My older brother, my best friend, and my father and I went, and it felt like we were the only guys at this show.
Yeah, boys' night out.
It was probably the loudest thing I'd ever heard, and it wasn't the show that was loud, it was just the screaming. It was at the Sky Dome in Toronto.
Oh, wow.
And it's just this massive sports arena, you know, and sports stadium, and it was just filled with, you know, 50, 60,000 screaming girls. It was insane. So yeah, that's my first experience with like live, like a big real concert was that, which was, you know, pretty absurd.
Yeah. Now what about that first record that shook you?
Well, I discovered the Beatles kind of on my own at a very young age, but that was more like, I just got into it right away, and I would try to find Beatles songs on the radio at night, just scrolling through the dial. But the first record that really kind of blew my mind was Nirvana, you know, Nevermind by Nirvana. I heard it at a party with older kids. I was at a party with kids like the year ahead of me in school. And someone put Lithium on, and I danced with a girl to it, and it was probably the best thing that ever happened in my life. Dancing with a girl to Lithium by Nirvana.
That's a really good story.
Yeah. Doesn't get any better than that.
Right.
Talk about, you know, we always mention the fact that music, like, it ingrains itself into you when you're a kid, and I know those songs really stick with you. That's man, what a good memory, dancing with a girl. What, there's no better song.
An older girl, nonetheless.
Woo, man.
Amazon Echo users, Chicago's conversation is three words away.
Play WGN Radio.
Chicago's news, weather, sports, all three words away.
Play WGN Radio.
Chicago's original social media, three words away. WGN Radio on Amazon Echo. Play WGN Radio.
The curse of the Billy Goat is over, and we've got Northside champions. But the Billy Goat lives on in the friendly taverns of Dot Chicago and in a brand new place, too, the freezer section of your local Jewel Osco. At any of the 185 Jewel Osco stores in the Chicagoland area, you'll find the world-famous Billy Goat burgers, frozen and ready to go home with you. Of course, you're the chef, but we highly recommend adding some cheese. That's how you'll be able to create the one and only world champion cheeseburger.
Hey, Illinois drivers, we can make zero fatalities a reality. For starters, cars and trucks, please be extra careful when driving next to each other. Also, if your phone isn't hands-free, it's illegal to use when driving in Illinois. So drop it and drive. And remember, when you see orange signs, look for the unexpected. Something ahead could result in a crash. See orange, slow down, save lives. Together, we can make zero fatalities a reality. Always drive safely and embrace the orange. Brought to you by the Illinois Department of Transportation.
Have you checked your Google search results lately? Search results are usually the first impression that people form of you or your business. So make sure that they create a positive impression with ReputationDefender.com. What the internet says about you can have a big impact on your life and your livelihood, even if it's not true. Fortunately, you can now control how you look online and in online search results with ReputationDefender.com. Call 800-401-3224 now. That's 800-401-3224 for your free reputation analysis. If you have negative material from an ex-employee, upset patient, or former client, newspaper article, legal issue, social media, or other source showing up in your search results, you can combat it with ReputationDefender.com. Our dedicated experts in patented technology can help make your online search results look their best. Call 800-401-3224 to learn more. 800-401-3224. That's 800-401-3224. Or visit ReputationDefender.com.
You know, you're coming back to the Midwest. You're playing Summerfest in Milwaukee, Chicago in September for Riot Fest. What are some of the things you like to do when you're in certain towns? Like when you get to Chicago, what are some of the things you need to hit up before you leave?
I try to make it. Is it the Green Mile?
The Green Mill.
Is that what it's called?
The Green Mill, sorry. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I like to make it the Green Mill. Mm-hmm. I've seen some amazing bands play there, you know, amazing jazz bands.
Yeah,
just like insane, just, you know, transcendent performances there. So I try to make it there if I'm around the neighborhood. I also, you know, most cities I go, if we have, you know, a day or a night, I'll try to find some, like, bomb-ass restaurant to go sit at the bar at and eat something weird.
Yeah. It's easy to do here. There's a lot of good food.
Yeah, definitely.
So I want to know, too, if I'm not mistaken, are you in L.A. now, like from Toronto but in L.A.?
I live in L.A., but I'm in Toronto.
Oh, currently. Okay, yeah. Cool. Well, that's a funny juxtaposition because I know, like, in L.A. right now, it's like 110 degrees or something like that, and then Toronto is probably much more mild, probably similar to Chicago. How has that adjustment been for you?
What, we're talking about the weather now? Jesus Christ.
It's a hard-hitting question.
Gets pretty hot in L.A. No, you know, whatever. This is when I come to Toronto. It's like the climate I'm accustomed to. It's in the summer. It's like Chicago. It's very humid and balmy, hot. The rains are crazy. You know, it's that lake weather. So, and it's very lush and you know, it's a living place. You know, everything is like mossy and undulating. And in LA, everything's on fire all the time, like super dry and crispy.
Yeah,
and you know, when it's not on fire, there's ants crawling everywhere. So, you know, it has, both of them have their advantages and their disadvantages. The disadvantages of LA is that, you know, it's a flaming dust bowl, but I love it.
Now, being from Toronto too, did you grow up a hockey fan?
I did not. No, I grew up like a music nerd.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm French Canadian, so that I was, you know, basically an apostate in my culture.
They were just not accepting at that time. Well, you know, I wanted to know, thanks again for joining us. Again, you can see him at Riot Fest and Summerfest, Sebastian Granger. I did want to get to the fact that you have made kind of a transition. You've changed and dropped the 1979 from the band name. Where did this come about?
Well, the band name originally was Death From Above, mm-hmm. and we ended up changing it before the first LP came out. For, you know, a number of reasons. But Jesse and I never stopped referring to the band as Death From Above, like through the years.
Yeah.
Unless we were, you know, it was pretty rare that we would use the full number name. So, on the last couple of tours, I think the first tour we did it on was the Eagles of Death Metal tour. We just decided to not use it on the posters just to see how people reacted and, mm-hmm. And some of our t-shirts didn't have it on it, on that tour. And we just tried it kind of on a whim to see if people would A, notice and B, care. And it was basically no one really discussed it. So we just kept doing it. And then when we started working on, you know, the new music and Freeze Me, I was making the art for the single, and the concept was to get these alphabet ice cube trays and spell out the name of the band and the name of the song and photograph it and then time-lapse the thing melting. And so I bought this ice tray, and it didn't have numbers on it. So I just decided, well, might as well just not use the numbers because they don't exist.
On the ice tray.
Yeah.
Sebastian,
that's it.
I love that, man. I love that because I only make mention of it because when I was going to college, I went to a small town in Utah for this college, and I went to this record store every single weekend. I remember always going to your album because it was the only one that was just had its own label under 1979. So it was like always
right there.
Referred to it with that. There's a lot to say about
cool.
it. Yeah, there's a lot to say about a band name. I mean, just like the fact that it's your imprint. I mean, we talked a little bit about the artwork that you guys did and how it's so iconic and the name. Do you feel like the name is kind of, you know, a vastly important part of who you are as a band?
That's really difficult for me to perceive personally.
Yeah, because you couldn't
band,
just...
The band to me is Jesse and I. And when I think of the band, I think of him, you know. So, mm-hmm. You know, I don't think of the name. I don't think of anything else. I just think of like, oh, that dude that I hang out with, you know, a bunch, and we make this noise together. So,
that's great.
That's cool.
It's like a little
like
family.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, so Jesse, have you?
We're like brothers.
Say that again.
We're like brothers.
Oh, brothers. Sebastian, you know, you guys started out, like we were saying, you know, we really jumped on in our college years, and you guys have really, I mean, you were headlining Coachella, you're at Riot Fest, you're all over the place now. Have you come across any moments where you've, like, met some of your favorite artists personally or had any of those, like, starstruck moments?
I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of it, but we had a moment last year after we recorded at Jack White's record label where we went bowling with Jack and Mick Jagger.
Holy
so
cow.
That's pretty much the apex of name dropping.
No kidding.
Not something I like to do. But it was this situation that was really absurd because it's pretty much the biggest, you're like hanging out with the biggest current rock star and the biggest rock star ever, you know. There's maybe one other guy that would be on the same level as Mick Jagger, and we were just hanging out, and it was like, you know, it was like hanging out with some buds. It wasn't
That's
like
cool.
It wasn't like witnessing a thing. It was like being in this very unique situation that will, you know, probably never be replicated in any fashion. And we just were totally in the moment and enjoying ourselves and, you know, laughing, making people laugh. And, you know, it was this weirdo thing that happened.
That's so cool.
That, you know, when I think back at it, it plays back like a scene in a movie.
Yeah.
So Mick Jagger, does he have his own ball or does he rent?
We were at Jack's personal bowling alley, and he has a wall that's all balls for other rockers. And I'm not sure if he had a Mick Jagger ball at the time, but I'm sure he has one now.
That is the coolest story, man.
Seriously, no kidding. And who was the better bowler of the bunch? Who kind of took the night? I know you don't want to share the details.
No, I mean, I'll say that I was winning until Jack started playing.
Wow. Well, he's got an unfair advantage. He's got his own bowling alley, I guess, so.
That's exactly what I said after I lost. I thought, well, this guy's got his own bowling.
Well, Sebastian, we can't thank you enough for joining us here on Sound Sessions here on WGN Radio. Thanks for joining us. Again, you can find him and Jesse at Summerfest on July 4th, Riot Fest here in September, all over the place. Pick up the new single, Freeze Me. Sebastian, thanks for joining us here on Sound Sessions.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Sound Sessions here on WGN Radio. This is Kevin.
And this is Michael.
And we have been sharing a lot of fun interviews this morning. We had about an hour and a half of Eric Griffin, then Tony Michaelitis, then Sebastian Granger, and now back to us. So we're going to be getting into the vault. I'm really excited about this. We've been sitting on some of these stories for so long. I'm excited to finally get these out.
Yeah, me too. I mean, it's such an exciting time for everybody, and especially with our music. And I think that we're able to... Okay, well, let me see here real quick. I think I'm able to play it from my computer if you want.
Oh, okay. Well, hopefully. Let's see if this works.
My heart's beating a little bit fast. Well, let's open up that vault.
We did it!
That's right, everybody. It's time for the Music Vault here on WGN Radio. Sound Sessions.
We have to make an amendment. We'll be tackling things other than just music on this vault. Would you like to start us off, Michael, or should I?
I'm just excited that we got the music to work.
I know. I can't believe we did it.
Fantastic. Kevin, why don't you just start up the fire a little bit, grease the tires a tad.
All right. So like I was teasing, there's big news in Chicago.
Okay.
Might not be good news. There have been several since I got this story. I think the first one I'm seeing here, the first witness came forward on April 7th. And since then... there's been a string of these sightings of the Mothman. Now, if you're not familiar with the Mothman, there's a movie called The Mothman Prophecies where this man-sized, moth-like, winged creature appears, and it's freaky, and it's got, like, glowing red eyes, and they see him on the side of this bridge. Is it Cincinnati, do you remember, Tom? Or it's Ohio somewhere, I want to say.
Yeah, I believe it was Ohio.
But so anyway, this moth appears on the side of this bridge, and people perceive it as an omen because shortly thereafter, the bridge collapses.
Oh.
So now, we're seeing this creature in Chicago, apparently. So let me read you some of these accounts.
He's here in Chicago? This is kind of scary.
I mean, I haven't seen him outright, but...
oh, my gosh.
But, yeah, you know, here's some of the eyewitness reports.
Okay.
So the first one I have is on April 15th. I don't have the one from April 7th, but that's apparently the first time a witness came forward. On April 15th, between 10 p.m., the first case, it took place between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. on April 16th. In the first account, the witness says, "We were about 2 miles out on the lake, just off of Montrose, at about 10 p.m. Now, this freaks me out because I live off Montrose, not far from the lake. The witness stated, "We were enjoying ourselves when I happened to look up and saw what looked like a giant bat. This bat was as tall as my husband, who is 6'4" or even bigger." Yikes.
Get out of town.
Now, hold on. The witness described the creature. "It was solid black with eyes that seemed to reflect the moonlight. This bat was blacker than the surrounding night sky and was perfectly silhouetted against the moonlit sky. This bat circled the boat 3 times in complete silence." Jeez, creepy. "Before heading off towards Montrose, it quickly blended into the night sky and was gone in seconds."
That's the scariest thing I've ever heard.
So there's that. 30 minutes later, the witness was hanging out with my boys and a few friends. I'm not sure.
What are the boys in the north side up to?
I'm curious what that is. But anyway, "As we talked about work and our families, we heard what sounded like a bird flapping its wings," the witness stated. "One of my homies yelled,
I love these accounts. One of my homies yelled out that he saw a huge lechuza over by the road. The lechuza, for if you don't know, mm-hmm. is a Mexican urban legend or myth about an old woman who can turn into a giant black bird. We walked over there and saw what looked like a big owl. As we walked up on it, the owl stood up on 2 feet and looked right at us. We saw what looked like a huge lechuza again, except it was 6 feet tall and really big. It had large glowing red eyes that were completely freaking everybody out. We all yelled, and this thing took off into the air and off toward North Avenue, where it was going to the beach. This thing freaked us all out, and it scared all our kids. Now, there's one more in this one. I can go on. There's a handful of accounts. Enter Lon Stickler.
What's Lon up to these days?
Well, he's an expert in the field of cryptids and the founder of the popular website Phantoms and Monsters. I love that. Frequent that website. He has received multiple reports concerning the recent rash of sightings in Chicago. Has been thoroughly investigating each one. There's countless accounts. Now, what's worrisome is that he goes on to say how, well, nothing is... So anyway, a stickler, that's Lon, right? Lon Stickler.
Mm-hmm. He's not a stickler. His name
is
Lon Stickler.
Well, he's a stickler to the Mothman facts. Okay. So if you get him wrong, he's going to correct you. So he was unsure why Chicago was specifically experiencing a flap of the flying... I see what they did there. Of the flying humanoid sightings. However, he did state, there are many opinions as to why these sightings are occurring, including a general feeling that unfortunate events may be in the city's future. Oh, that's well timed.
Yeah.
At this point, this is Stickler again. Mm-hmm. I feel that this being may be attempting to distinguish a connection between locales within the city and future events. The witnesses have been very steadfast with what they have seen and refuse to embellish on their initial descriptions. Each witness has a feeling of dread and foreboding, which I believe translates into a warning of some type. That's so there you have it.
Has anyone else? We want to put this out to the listeners really fast because this is the first time I'm hearing about this. So give us a call at 312-981-7200. Have you seen the Mothman? Do you know who he is? Do you know where we can call him? Does he like pizza?
What's his address?
Yeah, we got to know more about this Mothman.
If you're listening, Mothman, call in 312-981-7200. We take texts, you know?
But you can follow us on Twitter too, Mothman, if you'd like sound such
pop. What language does the Mothman speak, you think?
Evil.
Is that a language? Okay,
yeah,
sure.
Probably the language of just being a terrifying 7 foot. What is it? Lechuza?
Lechuga? Lechuza? Something like that.
Lechuga is lettuce.
Lettuce.
Well, so maybe it's a 7 foot piece of lettuce. I don't know.
This is the scariest thing ever because I'm thinking about this. You're in Chicago, and it says a lot of reports are found in Lincoln Park. I frequent Lincoln Park a lot.
Yeah, and to me, it's right off Montrose Avenue. Yeah. Can you imagine being on a boat and seeing like a 7 foot thing fly? No, thanks.
No, it reminds me of that movie Jeepers Creepers.
Yeah.
God.
One of the scariest.
It's freaky.
And underrated horror villains.
Yeah.
And they would like jet out of his back to you. Oh, man. See, this is what I'm picturing with this Mothman. So now I'm getting more afraid. And we're stuck in the Allstate Showcase studio in this box.
4:13 in the morning.
If the Mothman's out there and he's listening, come up to the glass and give us a little tap on the window.
Come visit this beautiful couple embracing each other on Michigan Avenue right now. I'm sure they would love a little visitor.
We've had a couple kissing for like the last 20 minutes here at the station. And it's keeping, so I'm a little bit afraid, but I'm also feeling a little bit of love in the air.
Yeah, we're balancing the yin and the yang, right? You got to balance each other out.
Are you ready to roll on to another story, Kev?
Yeah, can I get one more in?
Of course.
Because I've been
sitting
on this one for so long, and
yes.
I'm so excited.
Yes.
And again, if you have anything to input on these stories or any accounts, 312-981-7200.
Oh, you know what? Are you going to move on to another story?
Yeah, well, what do you have?
We have one text real quick who wanted to touch on the Mothman. Okay. From the 740. You know, Mothman was seen at Point Pleasant, Ohio. The Silver Bridge collapsed shortly thereafter.
See, that's what I'm saying.
And that's from Jay in Ohio. That's scary.
That is scary. That's what freaks me out. Like, what's going to happen in Chicago now?
He looks like he hangs out outside of not the downtown areas, but kind of on the outskirts of these downtown heavy populated villages.
Maybe he's just scoping out his next target.
Do you think that's what he's doing? He's going to open up a Starbucks shop and he's just like looking for the next corner to go on. Okay, let's hear the next story. I can't wait.
So I've been sitting on this one for way too long. I think we did a fill-in for like Noonan back in April or something like that. And I've been sitting on this. No, I think before that even. Just the best headline I've read in a long time. This comes from the Huffington Post. Patagonia, you know, the outdoor clothing line, right?
Yeah, kind of like an outdoorsy kind of wear.
Do we have Mothman on the line? Mothman coming in from the 709. Let's go
put this
Mothman
on pause for a second to talk to the one and only Mothman.
Hello, Mothman.
My name is Ingrid Cold.
Ingrid Cold?
It's very nice over here. Soon, you will see.
Okay.
Wow. You know,
thanks, Mothman.
Mothman, what have you been up to? Why are you traveling around Chicago? Why here? And how's Ohio?
Ohio will be fine. Okay. However, something big is coming to Chicago. Something wonderful.
Oh.
Well, thanks, Mothman. Have a good day.
I like that.
That was weird.
I was going to give the Mothman a pair of Chicago open air tickets. If
oh,
you wanted
maybe that's what he meant, the big thing to come to Chicago.
I think that's what he was leading to. Well, man, I've never had somebody that we've been talking about call us on air before.
And that was bizarre.
You saying he's real?
I don't know what that guy, or what, I'm walking away from this.
Let's move on to the next story then. Patagonia, greatest.
Should we come? No, you know what? I've been teasing this story for so long.
Yes.
So I'm going to do it right here before the break. Patagonia, this is the headline from Huffington Post. Patagonia, the outdoor clothing company, mm-hmm. Patagonia's new clothes are made from poop and dried beetles.
Nope.
Should I divulge more? Should I just leave
you
it
mean
at that?
They weren't before?
No. Well, see, that's the thing. So they're doing this because in an effort to dye its clothes without using toxic chemicals, the green-minded apparel company is making its new clean color collection with natural dyes sourced from 96% renewable resources. Those include dyes derived from the poop of silkworms, dried beetles, and byproducts of food waste. They said that many of its synthetic dyes use less water, energy, and carbon dioxide than its competitors, but it's looking forward further to reduce the environmental impact. So
they're making you wear...
So would you wear a poop jacket?
I'm glad you asked. No one's ever asked me that question before.
Well, I have a few.
You do?
For different reasons.
I was wondering what that smell was. if you're asking me seriously, I say, I think it'd be a great conversation piece.
Why not, you know?
I mean...
Like, my jacket's made of guano.
What's your jacket made of? Silk? Lame. How 2016?
That's right. You might have a silk jacket. Mine is made of the poop of the silkworm.
Tom, how about you? Do you think you would wear this jacket ever?
You know, yes. Mm-hmm. If it's for the environment, I feel like if it's low cost, or is it still going to be just as expensive to get the poop out of these silkworms?
Good point. I feel like there should always be a discounted price at this, since you're literally buying.
And who gets that job, by the way? What do you do? I work at Patagonia.
A guy with really small hands.
Maybe he's got a little tiny pooper scooper.
He's got to really massage it, you know, make it feel good.
So there you have it. We've covered Mothman. We've covered Patagonia's new poop clothes. Should we take a break and come back with more in the vault?
I think we should.
All right, you're listening to Sound Sessions here on WGN.
Welcome back to Sound Sessions here on WGN Radio. This is Michael and Kevin. We're continuing with our music vault. This is our look into the latest, hottest topics, news stories, whether it be music, whether it be Mothman, whether it be pants made out of poop.
What kind of music do you think Mothman likes?
I'm
thinking smooth jazz.
I would say mothcore.
Mothcore.
Nice one.
Well, speaking of Mothman, to finish this off, we've got one more text from the 312. I've seen 7 to 10 golden eagles late at night nearly every morning, or early morning, in the Lincoln Park area over the last 2 months. They do stand out about 4 feet tall. Because of the overpopulation of rabbits in the area, they have been in that area more often than before. So that's maybe a possibility. I've also heard maybe like pelicans, but that's like a big pelican.
Yeah. And I think
a big eagle.
I think you'd be able to tell the difference between a pelican and a Mothman, to be honest. And also, you know what? I've noticed, I read in the article, I knew this was going to happen once you brought up this story, but I read more into the article. He often comes out at only like 10 o'clock at night. It's not like he's hitting like the late hours.
You know, he's got a day job. Okay?
You think he has moth kids that he has to take care of?
You got a moth family, you got a moth rent to, you know, these things don't come free. Can't get moth money growing on moth trees. All right, anyway.
Well, let's change stories a little bit here for a second, even though I know we're going to eventually come back to Mothman, because this seems to be what everyone likes to talk about. Our man, Chicago's own Bill Murray and his brothers are officially bringing back Caddyshack and bringing it in restaurant style to Chicagoland.
Such good news.
Oh my gosh, this is the best news of the year. The Murray, they're going to officially call it Murray Brothers Caddyshack. in the Crown Plaza Hotel in Rosemont, according to a recent news release. Yeah, it's good. They're slating to debut it sometime in December after an initial report that came out, which I'm very excited about. It's going to be themed after the iconic movie Caddyshack. They're going to have crispy potato golf balls, salads, sandwiches, main desserts, and a golf-themed menu. I mean, for a fan of this classic 80s movie, what could be better?
Now, I'm seeing here there are a few Chicago nods on the menu in Florida, including a Chicago-style hot dog and Italian beef. Does that mean this already exists in Florida?
Yeah, it looks like it does. So it looks like they open up. I mean, it's a great idea. It would make no sense for them not to do it until now. So, of course, they did it before. I think they opened that in St. Augustine, Florida in 2001.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's been out there for a little bit. But, hey, we're excited to have it
here. Yeah, and it's going to be close to the airport. It's going to be people are going to love it. What a place for it to be. I'm seeing it's going to be large, 8,600 square feet, 265 seats. Jeez. An oblong-shaped bar. Many TVs showing. Hey, I'm in. Let's go check this out. This will be fun in December.
Call it Mothman. We're all going to get
you,
a quick dinner.
You, me, Tom, Roger, Mothman, we're going.
All right. As we mentioned before, we can run over this one really fast. We mentioned that Paul McCartney finally regained the Beatle rights after a 50-year-long battle. McCartney's rank for knighthood was actually elevated 20 years to Companion of Honor for his services in music. And on the same weekend, he had another success to celebrate, taking all the Beatles songs.
And did he get
back
those from the Jackson Estate?
From the Jackson Estate, yes. So what I didn't realize is when you're buying these huge music catalogs, you actually need to buy a company that licenses out this music. So Michael Jackson didn't buy Love Me Do for $20 here and then Sgt. Pepper's for $1,000. He bought the entire licensing company, and after a brief talk with Sony, which probably wasn't brief since he hasn't had these songs since the 70s, he was able to regain that company and have it all under his name. And I think that Paul McCartney still owns Apple Music, so good for him.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that he can get back into the groove of things.
Not to be confused with the streaming service.
Right. Yes. Apple Records. Yeah.
Apple Records. That's Apple Music. Apple Records.
So I've got one here to segue. So the latest internet hero. Have you guys seen the pizza delivery driver driving his little delivery cart through the G20 riots?
No.
Oh, it's funny. There's footage that exists on the web if you can find it. Maybe we can post it somewhere. But during the G20 protests in Hamburg on Thursday, it was not just the left-wing demonstrators attracting attention. There was a footage of a pizza delivery driver snaking through the crowds that appeared on live television footage. I saw it. So there's literally protests and riot gear and all this nonsense all over the place, and then there's this guy on a scooter with a Domino's pack on his back, and he's just weaving in and out. It's very funny. And this, what it made me remember was when we had the G20 summit here in Chicago, and this was 4 or 5 years ago.
Huge event, tons of security.
Oh my God, it was crazy. Well, and I worked at a valet company at the time, and I remember this particular day. I was leaving work at a hotel downtown, and I was going to Union Station to catch a train out to the suburbs, and I turn a corner into what turned out to be a standoff between protesters and the police. And I'm just casually, much like this delivery driver, just casually walking through the middle of it, not associated, sorry, I'm just getting to the train. But yeah, it was pretty intimidating to see.
That's terrifying, because especially in today's world, you never know what's going to happen with these huge protests and these huge crowds and the fights between police and civilians. And sometimes it's good to see, a little bit of joy brought do people buy a pizza?
Well, when you want pizza, you got to get pizza. And hopefully, I'm just hoping they gave him a good tip to go out during that hour.
Yeah, kudos to that guy. All right, Kevin, I got a little knowledge to drop on you real
quick.
Please
do.
Black bears have killed 61 people in North America since 1900, according to North America.
Wait, what was it, 60?
61.
Oh, yeah. Black bears.
Black bears.
Wow. Okay, I was going to say that seemed low, but black bears are not typically very aggressive, to my understanding.
No, they're like the Yogi Bear of the bear family.
Yeah, I've seen one before, and they ran away.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Did you give it a hug?
No. Well, no.
Okay.
God, no.
Good, because you would have been one of those. It's been 62.
Right, I would have been 62, yeah.
And that's from 1900. It's been a long time.
Yeah.
100 years. According to the North American Bear Center, so you know that it's true, a nonprofit organization that works to ensure the survival of these bears. And that actually leads me to the fact that this Kenyan runner was able to outpace two bears in a race for his life.
What was the Kenyan runner's name?
His name was...
I would love to hear it.
Mothman Marubu. It's actually Moninda
Marube?
Marube. A 38-year-old student from the University of Maine says he encountered these two black bears on July 5th while an early morning, get this, 18-mile training
just
run.
Just a casual 18-mile run.
Casual stroll
just
through the park.
Loose for the day.
Get a cup of coffee and you're going to be set. That 18 miles, that's like a full day for me.
So
I wouldn't be able to do
hold
it.
Hold on. So not only did he outrun bears, but he was on an 18-mile run during it. So he was probably well into the run and was able to still gather up the gusto to up and outrun these bears.
Mm-hmm.
That's remarkable.
I love the part of this story that explains about what he did as his options to run away from these people. So Mr. Marubi?
Yep, I'll take it.
Okay. He said he considered jumping into a nearby lake where bears had likely been headed for a drink.
Yeah, bears can swim, I'm pretty sure.
And then he thought, but that wasn't an option because I fear swimming,
oh.
He recounted. I fear water. Then he thought about climbing a tree, but realized that bears can do the exact same thing about that too. So he actually, the panicked runner actually thought he'd find shelter in a vacant camp building that he saw nearby. And the bears could have easily broken through these doors that separated from him, but they soon ran off into the woods because, as we mentioned before, that black bears are kind of nice when it comes
well,
to these people.
Well, and what's crazy about this, though, is people don't realize how fast bears are. Like,
oh,
I'm reading right here. Black bears are sure-footed and graceful and run at speeds of 25 to 30 miles an hour.
Dang.
That's crazy.
Just to be able to run that fast, that is you driving through on Michigan Avenue right here at 30 miles an
exactly,
hour.
Exactly.
So this is basically a story not only about a man who outrun two bears, but also a man discovering that bears are the ultimate predator.
Right. Like, for the first time knowing wow. that. I got one that we can close this segment off with if you're okay with that.
I'm so, so excited.
Headline says it all. Ryan Gosling's handsome doppelganger says looking like him is a little exhausting.
Poor, as it should be.
Poor guy.
Man.
So the internet, this guy came out as a doppelganger. His name's Johannes Lachette. He's a law student and menswear blogger who's a dead ringer for Gosling. I'm trying to see where he's from. But anyway, contrary to what you might believe, being as handsome as a Hollywood star can be a little exhausting and sometimes a bit too much. According to the law student at University of Bonn, whose father is a German politician, let's see, people started making the comparison to him, to Gosling, in 2005 while he was studying abroad. I am still me and nobody else, he wrote. On the other hand, you shouldn't complain if you have a resemblance to Mr. Gosling. It's better than if people would say, hey, you look like Danny DeVito. That's a good point. But, so yeah, can't you just take a compliment?
I know.
Can't you
know.
Just say, oh, thanks.
Now, is this the same guy who went on that award show as Ryan Gosling and accepted the award and gave the speech as Ryan Gosling?
No, I don't know anything about that.
That's Tom, hilarious. Did you hear about that?
No, I missed that.
So this guy, after the Oscars, Germany has their own set of Academy Awards, and there was this doppelganger that went into the crowd. He went through his own kind of security, went on the red carpet and everything.
Oh, my God.
And they presented him an award, and the thing is, when they present him like this like Lifetime Achievement Award or something, it was along those lines. He comes out, and he has a big old fat face. He looks a little bit like in
maybe,
passing,
yeah.
Like you might be able to see it, but it was the most ridiculous thing ever. And he just goes on stage and thanks everybody, and they all look very, very confused, and then he jumps off stage. So it's not the same guy.
I don't know.
This is like a thing.
I didn't realize there was this many dead ringers for Ryan Gosling, who also has a band, by the way. That's actually really good. Dead Man's Bones, I want to say.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Hey, Kevin, who do you get that you look like? I want to do a quick little
I get a Hemsworth every once in a while.
Oh, I see. Yes, that's right.
I get the Hemsworth here and there, but I don't have the Hemsworth biceps. That's the only problem.
I see it, though. You do kind of look like
Hemsworth. What about you?
I get Cillian Murphy from
that's a dead ringer for sure.
I get him a lot, and I used to get John Mayer. I used to have a little bit of
John Mayer. Okay, I can see that.
And then Mothman. Hey Tom, how about you? Who do you get?
I get overweight John Krasinski.
Oh, come
that's
on.
Not nice.
Hey man, you know no one said it had to be nice.
You look like a very handsome John Krasinski.
Look like a more handsome
thank
John
you.
Krasinski.
Pam would be all over you. Don't you worry, Tom.
Thank you,
Roger. Do you have one?
Yeah, the guy, there's one on every block. It's the old grumpy old man yelling to kids
oh, that's
get
you?
Off their lawn. That's
me.
You? Yeah.
Well, we need to get off your lawn anyway. We're stepping on your toes for the news. So let's take a quick break, and then we'll go to Roger Badish in the newsroom.
The president doesn't.
Sometimes you feel like
that means that it is not illegal.
Sometimes you don't.
Tear down this wall.
Here's Johnny.
Hey, Luke. May the force be with you.
It was you, Kristen, who shot J.R.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
We're not gay. Not
that there's anything wrong with that.
Charles, I've been waiting a long time to take the reins.
My name is Dave Letterman. Last night, I became a father. Thank you very much.
Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
In time, and the Chicago Cubs win the World Series. The Cubs have done it.
And now, this is history.
You're going to need outstanding hosts.
With Dave Plyer.
It's a guy, but I love you.
And Dave Schwann on 720 WGN.
What an intro that is.
I love that.
So, yeah, this is Kevin Richter and Michael Heidemann, Sound Sessions, collectively known, in for Dave Plyer, and we are thrilled to once again being joined by Dave Schwann for the This Is
History. The
Sound
Guys.
Mm-hmm. What's up, Dave? How are you?
Okay. How are you guys?
Doing well.
Having
Fantastic.
Fun?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Of course. So with that, I think we should just open up the old This Is History segment and get it going. In 1853... The first U.S. World's Fair opens in New York's Crystal Palace. It took 40 years until, and the event was held in... Wait, it took 40 years until the event like this was held in Chicago. The World's Columbian Exposition was held in... Yeah, I was going to say, it took a little bit. The World's Columbian Exposition was actually held in 1893, and the Century of Progress Exposition was held in 1933. And, you know, this is awesome because they... They don't really do this anymore, to be honest.
I don't think they do.
Why is that, Dave?
I'm not sure. The last one I remember, I do not remember 1933. My father was there, though. My dad was
really?
There.
Really? No
he
kidding.
Went. Yeah, he went. But the last World's Fair that I can remember where it was promoted and they made a big deal out of it was in all of all places, Knoxville, Tennessee, in the early 1980s. And then it just kind of faded. I think... travel being what it is, you know, the people simply weren't going there. You
right.
know, it became easier and easier to go to faraway places with, you know, cruise lines flying.
Sure.
In 1893, it was a long time to get from one end of Illinois to another, you know, rather than, you know, across the country. So all of the exotic things that they would bring into these world fairs, you could go see for yourself. In the places where they originated.
I guess that's a little better, maybe.
So awesome. You know, whenever I take a road trip or I go down to southern Illinois or I go to, you know, Indiana or Michigan, I often think about myself as I'm sitting in my nice air-conditioned car, the thought of people going on a stagecoach wagon, like, through the state of Illinois and how I'd be dead in the first, like, hour if we needed to do that again.
Right.
There was no air conditioning, nor was there any heat.
No kidding. Mm-mm. Let's move on here. In 1920...
Nor were any shock absorbers.
No. Oh, good point.
No one to ride shotgun either, speaking of shots.
Moving on. In 1923, the Hollywood sign is officially dedicated in the hills above Hollywood, Los Angeles. It originally reads Hollywoodland, but the last letters are dropped after renovation in 1949. Now, were you aware of that, either of you? I didn't know that.
Yes, it was Hollywoodland, and that was a real estate promotion.
Yeah, that's what I'm reading here. It's
promoting, sale of land around the area.
That's right, and it's really cool because of the way that it was able to bring other money to the county of Los Angeles was they auctioned off the letters, and actually Hugh Hefner owns Y. That's a little tidbit of information.
He owns the Y.
He didn't get the D.
Who said it?
Mark that. Send it. Send it to Nick.
That's very interesting. So let's move on again. In 1927, shortly thereafter, the Green Giant was launched, starting with their great big tender peas. Do we have an early commercial?
From the valley of the Jolly.
Ho, ho, ho.
Green Giant.
Couldn't resist.
From the garden in the valley. Valley of the Jolly Green Giant.
I wish they made jingles like this today.
Yeah, they should. They should bring this back, like the jingles of commercials and the World's Fair. I mean, that was just to say
all,
that right
all in
now.
One.
There was an animated visual that went along with that, where it showed the vegetables being picked and moved into the factory.
And they were probably all smiley.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very cool.
Smiling peas. It reminds me of like the early Simpsons when they used to play those like fake commercials.
Oh, right,
like
right.
Well, that's pretty neat. And I do love that song. It just takes you back, makes you feel
it
so.
It does. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of a comfort song. Like comfort food.
Exactly.
You have a comfort song.
All right. It's true. And like the thing is, that next to the Kit Kat song, two of my favorite songs ever. I run to those. In 1933, General Italo Balbo and his fleet of 24 seaplanes landed in Lake Michigan near Navy Pier. And I might be pronouncing that name wrong, so I apologize.
You're close.
Air Squadron flew to the World's Fair in Chicago, the Century of Progress, on a goodwill trip from Rome. And as a result, the 7th Street was named Balbo Drive.
Holy cow.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Yeah. It's not Balboa for the Italian explorer that found the Pacific Ocean. It's Balbo. That's right.
It's really interesting to hear like the origins of a lot of these names on the city, because there's like so much history, you know. It's really amazing.
You know, I just found out the other day, this is so funny, because I would always get stuck on traffic on Balbo Drive when I would be driving back from the suburbs.
Sure.
And then two, you know the street G-O-E-T-H-E?
Is it Geth?
You see that street, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just found out it's Goethe.
It's Goethe, yeah.
Goethe?
Goethe.
Goethe.
Where's the R?
Johann von Goethe. When you see the combination of the vowels O-E in German, it's an E sound. So it's Goethe.
Somebody told me that, and I was just like, because we were talking about philosophers, and I was like, I love Goethe. And they're like, who's
Goethe? Yeah.
Goethe? and by the way,
I think a lot of people around here say it Goethe.
Yeah,
I've heard of that. Yeah, or yeah.
And all these years, I've been just pounding these people with insults every time they say Goethe, and then I'm saying it wrong the entire time. And might I just add, one of my favorite quotes by Johann Goethe.
Let's hear it.
Is no man is more enslaved than those who believe that they are free. And that's just a quick quote from my good friend.
Wow, that's dark, man.
Do you have a quote from General Italo Balbo?
Yeah, he said, traffic more spaghetti, sucks. Please. More
Moving right along. In 1955, Disneyland televises its grand opening in Anaheim, California. First, let's hear, if we have it, the opening ceremonies that aired on Disneyland.
Everyone, this is Hank Weaver. For the past year, this signature has announced the opening of Disneyland the show. Now it announces the opening of Disneyland the place. The people and eyes around the world are focused on these 160 acres here in Anaheim, California. This afternoon, Disneyland, the world's most fabulous kingdom, will be unveiled before an invitational world premiere, and you are guests.
Wow, what would it take to get an invite to that?
You got
to
be a buddy with Walt, I guess.
You know, Dave, I was wondering, when Disneyland was coming about in 1955, what was there? Was there like an original theme park that they were kind of taking the idea from, or was Disneyland the original spot to go?
I'm going to venture a guess and say that that was an original. You know, it was based on theme parks and amusement parks, you know, that were around the country, Riverview being a perfect example here in Chicago,
yeah.
Coney Island being another example in New York. And I would imagine they had something out west, but the Disneyland thing was developed to, you know, kind of capitalize and expand on the Disney characters that Walt had promoted and created, really, through the years. So that was kind of the first of its kind when it came out. I was there when I was a kid in 1970 before they built Disney World.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was awesome. Awesome.
What a visionary he was. Different things. But this is like, you know, totally groundbreaking at the time. And
isn't it true? Because if you think about it, could you imagine that roundtable conversation of being like, guys, I have this idea. I know we're putting out these movies, but what if we made it into a real-life action theme park?
Right.
You would have been like, no, man. We don't have the money or the resources. This is crazy.
It's totally cool.
All right. Well, let's move on to 1966. This is going to take it down a little bit from our good times at Disneyland. Richard Speck rapes and kills 8 nurses in Chicago dormitory. Speck was an American mass murderer who systematically tortured and murdered 8 student nurses from South Chicago Community Hospital on July 14th, 1966. And this man was sentenced to death, but that sentence was later overturned due to issues with jury selection at his trial. Speck died of a heart attack after many years in prison at the age of 49 in 1966. 91. And, you know, we have actually some audio from a documentary produced by Chicago's own Bill Curtis. Let's take a listen right now.
In 1996, Chicago investigative journalist Bill Curtis uncovered a grotesque reminder of Richard Speck. The disturbing video in which Speck discusses the murders and shows evidence of his bizarre life behind bars.
How'd you feel after killing those ladies? Rock and roll is real. Had no freedom.
That is just terrifying. Yeah, you know,
it's really interesting. We had last year on the Bill and Wendy show, which I produced, we had a photographer who was closely related and one of the sisters, I believe, of one of these girls on.
Really?
Because he had put out, they had put out a series of photos of these girls that were slain, and their point was to not focus on the killer, but who these women were and like the actual beautiful people they were. You know?
Yeah.
It was a really powerful
suited
story.
Nurses.
You know how they found him? Do you know how they traced this crime to him?
How's that?
Well, first of all, when this happened, I can remember that is all you heard
right.
on the news for weeks. There was a one nurse that hid under a bed.
Oh, I did know
in
this.
The apartment where all of this horrific activity was taking place. She hid under the bed, remained perfectly still, and saw a tattoo on Richard Speck's arm that said "Born to Raise Hell," and they found him. You know, she gave a description of the guy, and police were following leads and so forth. He was in a what you might call a flop house, a transient hotel.
Yeah.
You know, a place where you could get a room for $5 a week or something like that. And he may have had a list of priors, you know, a prior record of some sort. That I don't know. But what I do know is that tattoo was the thing that gave him away. Born to Raise Hell. And found him on in a building on North Dearborn Street and arrested him.
Wow. What a story. Well, let's take a break here on that sour note. We'll get a little happier after that. But yeah, you're listening to This Is History segment, Dave Plyer and Dave Schwann's special. We'll come back for a little more after these breaks. Welcome back to Sound Sessions here on WGN Radio. This is Michael and Kevin in for Dave Plyer, and we're with Dave Schwann. We are doing the This Is History segment, and it's pretty interesting. This one I like a lot. 1969, the United States $500, $1,000, $5,000, and $10,000 bills are officially withdrawn from circulation. I didn't know those ever existed.
Me neither.
I saw a $1,000 bill once.
Who was on
once. I don't remember. I don't.
It should just be like Mount Rushmore.
It might have been. We'll have to Google this, I think.
Yeah.
It might have been.
We got producer Tom on it.
Let's see. The $100 bill was Benjamin Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been Alexander Hamilton, as in Hamilton, the guy, that's portrayed in the musical.
Was he on? Was he also on the 10 at that time, too?
No, oh, right. I'm thinking the 10. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Hey, come on. It's 10 to 5 on a Sunday morning here. I'm only on my second cup of coffee.
I got it.
Oh, you got Tom.
Apparently Grover Cleveland.
On the 1,000?
Yeah, $1,000 bill, Grover
Cleveland.
Who decided
he was worth that?
It's that mustache, though.
Okay.
Like, it's, holy cow, look
they
at that.
They all had those mustaches back then.
Very cool, though. I had no idea these were even a thing. I'd like to get my hand. I wonder what one like $1,000 bill is worth now, if you could get your hands on it.
If you could get your hands on it. Well, I mean, you could probably still use it, you know, as currency.
Can you break this?
Yeah, right.
It's
the smallest bill I've got.
Small coffee, please. Here's $1,000.
They look at you funny if you hand them any kind of cash these days. Everybody swipes a credit card.
All right. In 1984, we got the last episode of Happy Days, ran 11 seasons and 255 episodes later. And we got some fun facts to you. This is an amazing, amazing piece of Americana, which I used to love this show. When Nick at Night was first starting, this is a personal story. When Nick at Night was first starting, they played the show nonstop.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's why I got very familiar with it very quickly. And then, of course, it's bringing it around to music. The Buddy Holly Weezer video.
Yeah, was
all Happy Days related.
That's right.
So, I mean, that's pretty neat. But after the show, go ahead.
I was just going to say the season finale of Happy Days is a kind of I like it. It's warm and fuzzy feel to it.
Yeah.
That final scene where Howard raises his glass to toast everybody to happy days. That's just great.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's pretty cool.
It was wholesome, joyous fun. And the term jumping the shark came from the show Happy Days.
Is that where it's from?
Yeah, because it was the episode when they were about going into the 70s, I think, and Henry Winkler had to jump the shark as the Fonz, and that was like the big like go-to. That was the J.R. Who shot J.R. moment of Happy Days, I feel like.
It's pretty remarkable to see what some of these people went on to do in their careers too, like Ron Howard and who he's become today, and you know Arthur Fonzarelli played by what's his name? It's
Henry Winkler,
like yeah. You were just saying, right?
Mm-hmm. Arthur yeah. Fonzarelli.
Yeah. Oh, Arthur Fonzarelli. Also a great Instagram name. If you want to follow me on Instagram, it's Arthur Fonzarelli. I'm a huge fan of the show. And you know, one quick fact before we move on to the next thing. Although Fonzie actually loved motorcycles, Dave has a few lists of fun facts for us here. Even though the Fonzie loved motorcycles, Henry Winkler was actually terrified of them. Most scenes of Fonzie riding the motorcycle were shot with a bike attached to a platform and being pulled by a truck.
No kidding. I would not
I remember hearing something about that. Henry was very afraid of motorcycles.
In 1994... Can we guess what happened on this date or this week in 1994 involving O.J. Simpson?
Ah.
He's charged with murder and begins cooperating with authorities, giving hair samples for testing, a lot more ahead before the trial officially began. And what a zoo that trial was. I'm recently like going back and watching all these documentaries that are out right now. And O.J. Made in America, if you have not seen it, is so good. Mm-hmm. So good about it.
Dave, do you remember going through this and seeing this on the news all the time? Do you remember?
Oh, sure.
You had to have reported this story all the time.
Well, yeah, I was at Illinois Radio Network at the time, and of course it was a national story, and yes, you know, it filtered into everything. But it all started with the infamous car chase,
mm-hmm.
you know, where he was considered a fugitive from justice and running away.
But they were like, the police were cooperating with him, right? Because they were on the phone with, it's just.
They were trying to, were trying to apprehend him is
right.
What they were trying to do. Yeah. But I was at home. That was an evening thing when that car chase happened. I was working on something else at home. I'm sitting at my desk and watching this incredible thing unfold,
yeah.
You know, at the same time. And then, upwards of a year before the not guilty verdict was handed down. So
I remember it, too, actually. It's like I remember being very young and having, like, in my living room with my family, and we had aunts and uncles in town for some reason, and we were watching the car chase on live TV. And I didn't fully understand what was going on, but I do have a distinct memory of that. It's pretty
same. I was so confused that why we were watching this car just drive down the
just
road.
Just the white Bronco, just
the white
zooming
Bronco.
Down.
And you know who did a really great, speaking of news coverage, who I was introduced to when I was young was Walter Jacobson did an amazing perspective for months and months and months on this story. And every night on Fox News, he would do the perspective on the O.J. Simpson trial. So,
and what a segue that is, because we are out of time on the This Is History. Dave, that was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, guys. Keep up the great work.
Well, thank you. You do the same.
Yeah, Dave. Okay. Always good to see you, too.
You too.
We do have to get a look at Walter's perspective, which is brought to you by HearingHealthCenter.com.
There's something I thought I would never say, that to stop the violence in Chicago, what the police need are more guns. Not handguns, but military-style semi-automatic rifles. Like the ones fired recently on two policemen on patrol. It's a miracle both those guys are alive. And a reminder that in the gang wars on the southwest side of Chicago, military-style rifles have become the weapons of choice, easy to buy somewhere else, then so easy to sell here. They're the gold standard of mass murder weapons. More than 6 million of them are in circulation in the U.S. Last Sunday, in the Brighton Park neighborhood of Chicago, two masked gunmen firing assault rifles murdered two people and wounded eight more. In the past just 4 months in Brighton Park and back of the yards, 71 people have been shot. 71 people in 4 months. Police on the street are saying, in fact for many years have been saying, they are outgunned and too vulnerable, and that as a result, Chicago residents are too vulnerable. They're telling us that police pistols are no match for gangbanger rifles, that the police need to be trained and certified to bear and use rifles. The new president of the police union says he hopes the politicians and the media will come to realize how deathly dangerous police work is. I hope so, too.